I have my eye on a suite of rooms in Baker Street. You don't mind the smell of strong tobacco, I hope?
It's just a little too scientific for my tastes.
Ah, you've been in Afghanistan, I perceive.
But what on earth does he do? Verging on the cold-blooded, I would say.
Paid the penalty of their crimes.
Ah, Mr. Holmes, it is indeed kind of...
Boy, come here, boy.
Yes, m'lady?
What do you call this?
Scrambled eggs on toast with smoked herrings, m'lady.
In India, I have been used to being served breakfast where the toast is not scrambled and the eggs are not toasted. But this is London, not Calcutta. Take it back and get me the manager.
London. That great cesspool into which all the loungers and idlers of the empire are irresistibly drained.
Boy, I asked for thick-cut Oxford marmalade. You can tell by the colour. Thick-cut Oxford. Something to get your teeth into.
Oh, this is a comfortless, meaningless existence. I am as free as the air, and as free as my invalidity pension. 11 shillings and 6 pence a day. Dr. Watson?
Yes?
I asked for scrambled eggs.
The manager has asked me to pass on his compliments.
Thick cut, damn it!
And inquire whether you were minded to respond to his invitation concerning the matter he'd raised earlier.
This would not be tolerated in Calcutta.
And which you have been acquainted with.
Thick cut, English!
Yes, I will see him shortly.
This wouldn't happen at the Savoy.
Ah, the manager wishes to see me about my bill. I'm spending far too much money these days. It's as if I'm trying to buy happiness. I shall have to make a complete alteration in my style of living.
Watson! Good God! Watson, what have you been doing with yourself? You're as thin as a lath and as brown as a nut.
Young Stamford. It's young Stamford. Yes, we trained together at Bart's. Never a crony of mine. But the sight of a friendly face in this great wilderness of London is a pleasant thing indeed to a lonely man.
Stamford, my dear chap, how delighted I am to see you again. You must join me in Holborn for lunch. Let's hail a hansom.
A shattered shoulder, grazed subclavian artery, enteric fever, 9 months sick leave, and health irretrievably ruined.
Poor devil. What are you up to now?
Looking for lodgings and trying to solve the problem of finding comfortable rooms for a reasonable price.
That's a strange thing. You're the second man today who said just that.
And who was the first?
Sherlock Holmes. Works in the hospital laboratory. Says he's looking for somebody to share some nice rooms he's found.
Well, I'm the very man. I would much prefer having a partner to being alone.
Ah, but you don't know him. And if you did, I think you might not like him.
Why? What is there against him?
Oh, I didn't say there was anything against him. He's just a little queer in his ideas.
Bart's Hospital, sir.
If we don't get on, I'm sure it'll be easy to part company. But what is it about this fellow? You seem to want to wash your hands of the whole matter. Has he got a bad temper? Now, please be blunt.
I'm sorry, but it's rather difficult to express the inexpressible. He's just a little too scientific for my tastes. Verging on the cold-blooded, I would say.
What on earth do you mean?
Well, I could imagine him giving a friend a little pinch of the latest vegetable alkaloid. Not out of malice or anything like that. No, he'd do it in the spirit of scientific inquiry, to get an accurate idea of the effects.
Good Lord.
In here. I see the light's still on. Looks like we'll catch him at his work. No, to do him justice, I rather think he would take it himself. He has this passion for definite and exact knowledge.
Oh, very right, too.
Yes, but it may be pushed to excess. When it comes to beating the subjects in the dissecting rooms with a stick, it is certainly taking a rather bizarre shape.
Beating the subjects?
Yes, to verify how far bruises may be produced after death. I saw him at it with my own eyes. Well, here we are. You must form your own impressions.
I found it. I found it! I have found a reagent which is precipitated by hemoglobin and by nothing else.
Ah. Dr. Watson, Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
How are you? Ah, you've been in Afghanistan, I perceive.
How on earth did you know that?
Never mind. The question is now about hemoglobin. No doubt you see the significance of this discovery of mine.
It is interesting chemically, no doubt. But practically...
Why, man, it is the most practical medico-legal discovery for years. Don't you see that it gives us an infallible test for bloodstains? Come over here. Let's have some fresh blood. Now, I add this small quantity of my blood to a litre of water. Mm-hmm. You perceive that the resulting mixture has the appearance of pure water.
Mm-hmm.
The proportion of blood can be more than one in a million. A few white crystals. Some of this.
Ha ha! You see? You see that?
Yes, I can see a brown, dusty precipitate in the bottom.
And what do you think?
Seems to be a very delicate test.
Beautiful, beautiful. The old Guaiacum test was very clumsy and uncertain. So is the microscopic examination of blood corpuscles. The latter is valueless if the stains are a few hours old. Now, this appears to act as well, whether the blood is old or new. Had this test been invented, there are hundreds of men now walking the earth who would long ago have paid the penalty of their crimes.
Indeed.
Criminal cases are continually hinging upon one point. A man is suspected of a crime months, perhaps, after it has been committed. His linen or clothes are examined, and brownish stains discovered upon them. Are they blood stains, rust stains, fruit stains, or what are they? That is a question which has puzzled many an expert. And why? Because there was no reliable test. Now we have the Sherlock Holmes test. And there will be no longer any difficulty.
You are to be congratulated.
There was the case of von Bischoff at Frankfurt last year. He would most certainly have been guillotined had this test been in existence. Then there was Mason of Bradford and the notorious Muller. And Lefebvre of Montpellier. And Samson of New Orleans. I could name a score of cases in which it would have been decisive.
You seem to be a walking calendar of crime. You might start a paper on those lines. Call it the Police News of the Past.
Very interesting it might be, too.
Mm. We came here on business. My friend here wants to take diggings. And as you were complaining that you could get no one to go halves with you, I thought I'd better bring you together.
The capital? I have my eye on a suite of rooms in Baker Street. You don't mind the smell of strong tobacco, I hope?
I always smoke ships myself.
I generally have chemicals about and occasionally do experiments. Would that annoy you?
By no means.
I get down in the dumps at times, don't open my mouth for days on end. I'm not sulking. Just leave me alone and I'll soon be right. So, what have you got to confess?
I don't like rows. My nerves, you see. And I get up at all sorts of ungodly hours. I'm extremely lazy. Well, there are many more vices, but these are my principal ones.
Would violin playing amount to a row, in your opinion?
It depends on the player. A well-played violin is a treat for the gods. A badly played one.
Well, that's settled. Come for me at noon tomorrow, and we'll go and see the rooms together.
All right. Noon exactly.
Dolstenberger gets 10 years. Read all about it in the Star. In your Star tonight.
Dolstenberger gets 10 years. Oh, that's just his little peculiarity. So many people have wanted to know how he finds these things out.
Oh.
You'll find him a knotty problem, though. I'll wager he learns more about you than you about him.
Oh. Good morning. Hmm? Good morning. I have made an interesting discovery.
It's extraordinary what sleep can do. Shall I ring for breakfast?
Sleep, my dear Watson. I have just returned from the laboratory. I've been investigating the properties of human skin. Did you know human skin has completely different properties when placed under the flame compared to that of other mammals?
No, I had no idea. Now, if you just let me get dressed...
I've experimented with some specimens from the mortuary. The origin of the skin's position is also a
striking
man.
Over 6 feet tall. So excessively lean, he seems considerably taller.
eyes sharp and piercing, and a thin hawk-like nose giving his whole expression an air of alertness and decision. His chin, too, has prominence and squareness, and his hands are blotted with ink and stained with chemicals. Yet just look at him now, manipulating his fragile philosophical instruments with an extraordinary delicacy of touch. What on earth does he do for a living?
Last, unlock the mystery.
Well, I'm glad you're deriving so much enjoyment from your medical research. How many more years to go before you qualify?
No, my dear Watson. I'm not studying medicine, merely. I am applying my mind selectively over the vast plane of human existence.
I don't pretend to understand the universe. It's a great deal bigger than I am.
Quite. Oh. My dear Watson, how very profound. And rather original, if I may say so.
Oh, I'm just quoting Thomas Carlyle.
Who?
Carlyle. You know, Carlyle.
Never heard of the chap. Is he some astronomer?
No, I don't think so. Although he was most interested in the movement of the planets.
Well, I suppose he would be. Particularly as we are used to the movement of the sun round the planets.
But the planets always move around the sun. That's the Copernican theory. Holmes, are you trying to pull my leg?
You appear to be astonished that I have not the faintest idea what you're talking about. Now that I do know, I shall do my best to forget it.
To forget it?
You have to understand that I consider a man's brain, originally, as like a little empty attic, and you have to stock it with such furniture as you choose. A fool takes in all the lumber of every sort that he comes across, so that the knowledge which might be useful to him gets crowded out.
Or nothing can exceed this man's energy when the working fit is upon him. Yet there have been days when he would lie upon the sofa in the sitting room, hardly uttering a word or moving a muscle from morning to night. On these occasions, I have noticed such a dreamy, vacant expression in his eyes that I think he may be addicted to some narcotic. But this morning, his eyes are as sharp as a surgeon's scalpel.
The room has elastic walls and stretch to any point. Depend upon it, there comes a time when for every addition of knowledge you forget something that you knew before. It is of the highest importance, therefore, not to have useless facts elbowing out the useful ones.
But the solar system!
What the deuce is it to me? You may say that we go round the sun. If we went round the moon, it would not make a pennyworth of difference to me, or to my work. I do hope you will enjoy your breakfast. I have an idea about these skin residues, and I must return to the laboratory.
Sometimes he spends the entire day and night in the chemical laboratory, sometimes in the dissecting rooms, and occasionally in long walks through the more sordid districts of the city. But what on earth does he do?
Good afternoon. I've come to see Mr. Holmes.
Yes, of course. Please, come in.
Good morning. I would like to see Mr. Holmes, if you please.
Oh, yes. Please, follow me.
Thank you so much.
My dear Watson, I do apologize, but I wonder if you'd mind if I used the sitting room yet again. You see, I have to use this room as a place of business, and these are my clients.
I have had a strange dream. That Holmes was applying for a post in some important institution. I was in the dream, playing the role of some sort of official who had to suggest an appropriate position for him.
Mr. Holmes, are you familiar with the works of Tennyson?
Not in the least.
What? Have you never heard of the man?
I may have heard of him at some stage, but I have entirely excluded his existence from my mind.
What about the works of Trollope?
What about them?
Have you forgotten his literary achievements as well?
It matters not whether I have forgotten them or not. Trollope has no significance in my memory. In that case, he is an irrelevance.
Mr. Holmes, how would you define your knowledge of literature?
Nil.
I beg your pardon?
He said nil.
And your knowledge of philosophy?
Nil.
Astronomy?
What is astronomy?
Politics?
Feeble. I find voting in elections a rather futile exercise.
Do you know anything about botany?
I am familiar with belladonna, opium, and poisons generally.
What about roses and geraniums? You don't grow them by any chance.
I have always regarded practical gardening a rather time-consuming activity. There is no investigative value in growing a fine pink rose, nor, if I may say so, winning a cup for cultivating a pot of geraniums.
Have you any interest in geology?
practical but limited. I could not tell you if the ground we stand on is Precambrian, Jurassic, or Cretaceous, but I'm aware from the splashes of mud upon your trousers that the soil colour and grain size are consistent with your having travelled from the Blackheath area of London this morning.
Astounding.
What is the extent of your knowledge of chemistry?
I would say profound.
Anatomy?
Accurate but unsystematic.
Mr. Holmes, you've told us that you consider literary knowledge an irrelevance. Does that mean to say you are not particularly interested in reading?
Your deduction is based upon an erroneous assumption. I find that I'm able to read those books that are useful for my work. I have an immense knowledge of sensational literature. I believe I would be able to recount to you every detail concerning the case of the Heidelberg Strangler or the child killer of Marseille. In fact, I would be so bold to say that I am aware of every detail of every horror perpetrated this century. However, I do not profess to have any knowledge of the works of William Shakespeare. I find that the rather fanciful fantasies of an Elizabethan playwright are not rooted in any sense of reality.
Mr. Holmes, do you engage in any sport?
I have for some time maintained a keen interest in boxing and the art of sword fencing. I have found that a safe passage through somewhat notorious areas of the metropolis depends upon a certain expertise with regard to single-stick playing.
Does music fall into one of your categories of irrelevant activity?
On the contrary, I find playing the violin conducive to clear thinking.
Before we retire to consider your application, are there any factors you wish us to take into account?
Just this, such a retirement at this stage would be contrary to the rules of natural justice. You must seek an opinion from the moderator, Dr. Watson. This principle was established in the case of the Ipswich poisoner. Court of the King's Bench, 1845, I believe. You see, I have a good practical knowledge of British law.
Indeed you do, Mr. Holmes. Indeed you do. Dr. Watson?
Yes?
Have you anything to say that might assist us in our task?
Good sirs, I am in despair. I have tried and tried to find out what this fellow is driving at by reconciling all his rather eccentric accomplishments. I have tried and tried to think of a calling which would need them. I may as well give up the attempt at once.
Oh, God. Oh.
My dear Watson, I've woken you up. I'm most sorry.
Oh, no, not at all.
May I compensate you with some Mendelssohn Lieder?
Oh, I'm feeling petulant this morning. Where's my breakfast? Oh, not here, of course, because I am up too early. Our housekeeper is used to serving me at a more bohemian hour. What's this? Magazine article. The Book of Life. A somewhat ambitious title. Good God. What a load of exaggerated nonsense and far-fetched deductions. And this ridiculous writer says you only have to observe a twitch of a muscle, a glance of an eye, to fathom a man's most innermost thoughts. By a man's fingernails, by his coat sleeve, by his boot, by the trouser knees, by the callosities of his forefinger and thumb, by his expression, by his shirt cuff, by each of these things, a man's calling is plainly revealed. That all united should fail to enlighten the competent inquirer in any case is almost inconceivable. What ineffable twaddle! I've never read so much rubbish in my life.
What is it?
Ridiculous article. I see that you've read it since you've marked it. I don't deny it's smartly written, but it irritates me. It's clearly the theory of some armchair lounger who evolves all these neat little paradoxes in the seclusion of his own study. It's simply not practical. I should like to see him clapped down in a third-class carriage on the Underground and asked to give the trades of all his fellow travellers. I would lay 1,000 to 1 against him.
You would lose your money.
That's the article. I wrote it myself.
You?
I have a turn, both for observation and for deduction. The theories which I have expressed there, and which appear to you to be so wild and fanciful, are really extremely practical. So practical that I depend upon them for my bread and cheese.
And how?
Well, I have a trade of my own. I suppose I am the only one in the world. I am a consulting detective, if you can understand what that is. Here in London, we have a lot of government detectives and a lot of private ones. When these fellows are at fault, they come to me, and I'm generally able, by the help of my knowledge of the history of crime, to set them straight. There is a strong family resemblance about misdeeds. And if you have all the details of a thousand at your fingertips, it is odd if you can't unravel the thousand and first. Lestrade is a well-known detective. He got himself into a fog recently over a forgery case, and that is what brought him here.
And these other people who keep coming round?
They are mostly sent on by private inquiry agencies. They're all people who are in trouble about something and want a little enlightenment. I listen to their story, they listen to my comments, and then I pocket my fee.
But do you mean to say that, without leaving your room, you can unravel some knot which other men can make nothing of, although they have seen every detail for themselves?
Quite so. I have a kind of intuition that way. Now and again, a case turns up which is a little more complex. Then I have to bustle about and see things with my own eyes. You see, I have a lot of special knowledge which I apply to the problem and which facilitates matters wonderfully. Those rules of deduction laid down in that article which aroused your contempt are invaluable to me in my practical work. Observation with me is second nature. You appeared to be surprised when I told you on our first meeting that you had come from Afghanistan.
You had been told, no doubt.
Nothing of the sort. I knew you came from Afghanistan. From long habit, the train of thoughts ran so swiftly through my mind that I arrived at the conclusions without being conscious of the intermediate steps. There were such steps, however. The train of reason ran in this way. Here is a gentleman of a medical type, but with the air of a military man. Clearly an army doctor, then. He has just come from the tropics, for his face is dark, and that is not the natural tint of his skin, for his wrists are fair. He has undergone hardship and sickness. As his haggard face says clearly, his left arm has been injured. He holds it in a still and unnatural manner. Where in the tropics could an English army doctor have been in such hardship and got his arm wounded? Clearly, in Afghanistan. So, you see, the whole train of thought did not occupy a second. I then remarked that you came from Afghanistan, and you were astounded.
It is simple enough, as you explain it. You know, you remind me of Edgar Allan Poe's Dupin. I had no idea that such individuals did exist outside of stories.
No doubt you think that you are complimenting me in a comparison with Dupin. Now, in my opinion, Dupin was a very inferior fellow. That trick of his of breaking in on his friend's thoughts with an apropos remark after a quarter of an hour's silence is really very showy and superficial. He had some analytical genius, no doubt, but he was by no means such a phenomenon as Poe appeared to imagine.
Have you read Gaboriau's works? Does Lecoq come up to your idea of a detective?
Lecoq was a miserable bungler. He had only one thing to recommend him, and that was his energy. That book made me positively ill. The question was, how to identify an unknown prisoner? I could have done it in 24 hours. Lecoq took 6 months or so. It might be made a textbook for detectives to teach them what to avoid.
This fellow may be very clever, but he's certainly very conceited.
There are no crimes and no criminals in these days. What is the use of having brains in our profession? I know well that I have it in me to make my name famous. No man lives or has ever lived who has brought the same amount of study and natural talent to the detection of crime which I have done. And what is the result? There is no crime to detect, or at most some bungling villainy with a motive.
I wonder what that man out there in the street's looking for. Yeah, he's plainly dressed and seems to be carrying a letter.
Oh, you mean that retired sergeant of marines?
Brag and bounce. The impudence and conceit. He knows I can't verify this outrageous guess.
Ah, look. He's coming across the road, and I imagine will be visiting us in a second.
Ah, I'll get it. Good morning.
Good morning. I've come for Mr. Sherlock Holmes. This letter.
Thank you.
I hope you don't mind me asking, what your trade may be?
Commissionaire, sir. Uniform away for repairs.
And you were
A sergeant, sir. Royal Marine Light Infantry, sir. No answer, Mr. Holmes.
No, my good man.
Right you are, sir.
How in the world did you deduce that?
Deduce what?
Why, that he was a retired sergeant of Marines.
I have no time for trifles. Excuse my rudeness. You broke the thread of my thoughts. But perhaps it's just as well. So you actually were not able to see that the man was a sergeant of Marines?
No, indeed.
It was easier to know it than to explain why I know it. If you were asked to prove that 2 and 2 made 4, you might find some difficulty, and yet you are quite sure of the fact. Even across the street I could see the great blue anchor tattooed on the back of the fellow's hand. That smacked of the sea. He had a military carriage, however, and regulation side whiskers. There we have the Marine. He was a man with some amount of self-importance and a certain air of command. You must have observed the way in which he held his head and swung his cane. I must open the letter he brought. A steady, respectable, middle-aged man, too, on the face of him. All facts which led me to believe that he had been a sergeant.
Wonderful.
Commonplace. Ah. I said just now that there were no criminals. It appears that I am wrong. Look at this.
My dear Mr. Sherlock Holmes, there's been a bad business during the night at 3 Lauriston Gardens off the Brixton Road. Our man on the beach saw a light
in there about 2 o'clock in the morning, and as the house was an empty one, suspected that something was amiss. He found the door open, and in the front room, which is bare of furniture, discovered the body of a gentleman, well-dressed and having cards in his pocket bearing the name of Enoch J. Drebber, Cleveland, Ohio, USA. There had been no robbery, nor is there any evidence as to how the man met his death. There are marks of blood in the room, but there is no wound upon his person. We are at a loss as to how he came into the empty house. Indeed, the whole affair is a puzzler. If you can come round to the house any time before 12, you will find me there. I've left everything in statu quo until I hear from you.
If you are unable to come, I shall give you fuller details and would esteem it a great kindness if you would favour me with your opinion. Yours faithfully, Tobias Gregson. Why, this is terrible!
Gregson is the smartest of the Scotland Yarders. He and Lestrade are the pick of a bad lot. They're both quick and energetic, but conventional, shockingly so. They have their knives into one another, too. They are as jealous as a pair of professional beauties. There would be some fun over this case if they both are on the scent.
Surely there's not a moment to be lost. Shall I go and order you a cab?
I'm not sure about whether I shall go. I'm the most incurably lazy devil that ever stood in shoe leather. That is when the fit is on me.
Why, it is just the sort of chance you've been longing for.
My dear fellow, what does it matter to me? Supposing I unravel the whole matter, you may be quite sure that Gregson, Lestrade and company will pocket all the credit. That comes of being an official personage.
But he begs you to help him.
Yes, he knows that I'm his superior, and he acknowledges it to me, but he would cut his tongue out before he would own it to any third person. However, we may as well go and have a look. I shall work it out on my own hook. I may have a laugh at them, if I have nothing else. Come on, get your hat.
Oh, you really want me to come along with you?
Yes, if you have nothing better to do. I have never liked the look or the sound of Pomona fiddles. In my opinion, every violinist should be able to play a Stradivarius or an Amati at one point during his playing career. Oh, don't you agree, my dear Watson?
You don't seem to give much thought to the matter in hand.
No doubting it. It's a capital mistake to theorize before you have all the evidence. It biases the judgment.
Ah, you'll have your data soon. This is the Brixton Road. And that is the house, if I'm not very much mistaken.
No, it is.
Stop! Driver! Stop!
Why he wishes to tramp the last 100 yards is beyond me. It's wet and very gloomy. Ah, number 3 Lauriston Gardens. 3 tiers of vacant, melancholy windows. Black and dreary, and a to-let card. Reminds me of a cataract I had to treat on a bleary-eyed old general. The place is sloppy from the rain. Here's a police constable. Knots of loafers craning their necks in the hope of sighting a body. This is quite grotesque. Good God, what is Holmes doing now? He's lounging up and down the pavement with a manner bordering on affectation. Now he's gazing down at the ground. Now he's smiling. But I can't for the life of me see how he could hope to learn anything from the wet soil. We've had clod-hopping policemen tramping all over it for hours.
Ah, Mr. Holmes, it is indeed kind of you to come. I have had everything left untouched.
Except that if a herd of buffaloes have passed along, there could not be a greater mess. No doubt, however, you had drawn your own conclusions, Gregson, before you permitted this.
I've had so much to do inside the house. My colleague, Mr. Lestrade, is here. I'd relied upon him to look after this.
With two such men as yourself and Lestrade upon the ground, there will not be much for a third party to find out.
I think we have done all that can be done. It's a queer case, though. I knew your taste for such things.
You did not come here in a cab?
No, sir.
Then let us go and look at the room.
You always get a feeling about the presence of death. So here it is. Large square room. No furniture to speak of. Vulgar wallpaper. Blotched with mildew. Great strips of it hanging down. White imitation marble mantelpiece with the stump of a red wax candle. So, here we are. The deceased. Grim, motionless, stretched upon the boards, and vacant, sightless eyes. Age, about 44. Build, middle-sized, hair colour, black, curling, short, stubbly beard, clothes, heavy black frock coat, waistcoat with light grey trousers, immaculate collar and cuffs. Position of body, hands clenched and arms thrown out, lower limbs interlocked. His death had clearly been a grievous one. Face. Good God. An expression of horror. Hatred, it would seem to me, that I've never seen upon human features. He looks almost ape-like with his terrible malignant contortion. Blunt nose. Ugly jaw.
This case will make a stir, sir. It beats anything I've seen, and I'm no chicken.
There is no clue.
None at all.
You are sure there is no wound?
Positive.
Positive.
Then, with these numerous gouts and splashes of blood lying around, it would suggest that the blood must belong to a second individual, presumably the murderer, if murder has been committed. It reminds me of the circumstances attendant on the death of Van Jansen in Utrecht in the year 34... Do you remember the case, Gregson?
No, sir.
Read it up, you really should. There's nothing new under the sun. It's all been done before.
This is really a sight to behold. His fingers are flying here, there and everywhere. Feeling, pressing, unbuttoning. Oh, he's sniffing the dead man's lips. Now glancing at the soles of his patent leather boots.
He's not been moved at all.
No more than was necessary for the purposes of our examination.
You can take him to the mortuary now. There is nothing more to be learned.
Constables, it's a stretcher bearer. For
you, sir.
Ah, there's been a woman here. It's a woman's wedding ring. Here, have a look.
Oh, dear, this does complicate matters. Heaven knows they were complicated enough before.
You're quite sure it doesn't simplify them? Hmm? There's nothing to be learned by staring at it. What did you find in his pocket?
We have it all here. A gold watch, number 97163 by Barrow of London. Gold Albert chain, very heavy and solid. Gold ring with Masonic device. Gold pin, bulldog's head with rubies as eyes. Russian leather card case with cards of Enoch J. Drebber of Cleveland, corresponding with the EJD upon the linen. No purse, but loose money to the extent of £7.13. Pocket edition of Boccaccio's Decameron, with the name of Joseph Stangerson upon the flyleaf. Two letters, one addressed to E.J. Drebber and one to Joseph Stangerson.
At what address?
American Exchange, Strand. to be left till called for. They were both from the Guiyang Steamship Company and referred to the sailing of their boats from Liverpool. It's clear that this unfortunate man was about to return to New York.
Have you made any inquiries as to this man, Stangerson?
I did it at once, sir. I've had advertisements sent to all the newspapers, and one of my men has gone to the American Exchange, but he's not returned yet.
Have you made any contact with Cleveland?
We telegraphed this morning.
How did you word your inquiries?
He simply detailed the circumstances and said we should be glad of any information which could help us.
You did not ask for particulars on any point which appeared to you to be crucial?
I asked about Stangerson.
Nothing else? Is there no circumstance on which this whole case appears to hinge? Will you not telegraph again?
I've said all I have to say.
Mr. Gregson, I have just made a discovery of the highest importance, and one which would have been overlooked had I not made a careful examination of the walls. Come here. Now, come here. Now, stand there. Look at that.
On the yellow plaster, where the paper has peeled off, scrawled in blood, red letters, R-A-C-H-E, Rache.
What do you think of that? This was overlooked because it was in the darkest corner of the room, and no one thought of looking there. The murderer has written it with his or her own blood. You see that smear where it's trickled down the wall? That disposes of the idea of suicide anyhow. Now, why was that corner chosen to write it on? I will tell you. See that candle on the mantelpiece? It was lit at the time, and if it was lit, this corner would be the brightest instead of the darkest portion of the wall.
And what does it mean, now that you have found it?
Mean? Why, it means that the writer was going to put the female name Rachel, but was disturbed before he or she had time to finish. You mark my words. When this case comes to be cleared up, you will find that a woman named Rachel has something to do with it.
Uh-huh.
It's all very well for you to laugh, Mr. Sherlock Holmes. You may be very smart and clever, but the old hound is the best when all's said and done.
I really beg your pardon. You certainly have the credit of being the first to find this out, and, as you say, it bears every mark of having been written by the other participant in last night's mystery. I have not had time to examine this room yet. With your permission, I shall do so now.
Ah, here he goes again. Tape measure. Large round magnifying glass. He's flat on his face now. You know, he reminds me of a pure-blooded, well-trained foxhound as it dashes backwards and forwards, whining in its eagerness until it comes across the lost scent. He seems to be measuring invisible marks. Why is he applying the tape to the wall? He's gathering a little pile of dust and putting it away in an envelope. Now he's going over the red letters on the wall with his glass.
They say that genius is an infinite capacity for taking pains. It's a very bad definition, but it does apply to detective work.
Have you come to any conclusion?
What do you think of it, sir?
It would be robbing you of the credit of the case if I was to presume to help you. You are doing so well now that it would be a pity for anyone to interfere. If you will let me know how your investigations go, I shall be only too happy to give you any help I can. In the meantime, I should like to speak to the constable who found the body. Can you give me his name and address?
Ah, John Rance. He's off duty now. You will find him at 46 Audley Court, Kennington Park Gate.
Come along, Dr. Watson. We shall go and look him up. I'll tell you one thing which may help you in the case, my dear Lestrade and Gregson. There has been a murder done, and the murderer was a man. He was more than 6 feet high, was in the prime of life, had small feet for his height, wore coarse, square-toed boots, and smoked a Trichinopoly cigar. He came here with his victim in a four-wheeled cab, which was drawn by a horse with three old shoes and one new one on his off foreleg. In all probability, the murderer had a florid face, and the fingernails of his right hand were remarkably long. These are only a few indications, but they may assist you.
If this man was murdered, how was it done?
Poison. Oh, and one other thing, Lestrade. Rache is the German for revenge. So don't lose your time looking for Miss Rachel. Come, Watson. We must be off. Audley Court, Kennington Park Gate, please.
You were a while sending that telegram.
Indeed, it was a fairly long one, but I think it is important to understand there is nothing like first-hand evidence. As a matter of fact, my mind is entirely made up of the case. But still, we may as well learn all that is to be learned.
You amaze me, Holmes. Surely you're not as sure as you pretend to be of all those particulars which you gave to Lestrade and Gregson.
There is no room for mistake. The very first thing which I observed on arriving there was that a cab had made two ruts with its wheels close to the curb. Now, up to last night, we have had no rain for a week. So that those wheels which left such a deep impression must have been there during the night. But there were the marks of the horse's hooves, too. The outline of the one which was far more clearly cut than that of the other three, showing that there was a new shoe. Since the cab was there after the rain began, and was not there at any time during the morning, I have Gregson's word for that, it follows that it must have been there during the night, and therefore that it brought those two individuals to the house.
Well, that seems simple enough. But how about the other man's height?
Why, the height of a man in 9 cases out of 10 can be told from the length of his stride. It is a simple calculation enough, though that is no use my boring you with the figures. I had this fellow's stride both on the clay outside and on the dust within. Then I had a way of checking my calculation. When a man writes on a wall, his instinct leads him to write about the level of his own eyes. Now, that writing was just over 6 feet from the ground. It was child's play.
And his age?
Well, if a man can stride 4.5 feet without the smallest effort, he can't be yellow and withered with age. That was the breadth of a puddle on the garden walk, which he had evidently walked across. Patent leather boots had gone round, and square toes had hopped over. There is no mystery about it at all. I am simply applying to ordinary life a few of those precepts of observation and deduction which I advocated in that article that so annoyed you. Is there anything else that puzzles you?
The fingernails and the trichinopoly.
The writing on the wall was done with a man's forefinger dipped in blood. My glass allowed me to observe that the plaster was slightly scratched in doing it, which would not have been the case if the man's nail had been trimmed. I gathered up some scattered ash from the floor. It was dark in colour and flaky, such an ash as is only made by Trichinopoly cigars. I have made a special study of cigar ashes, in fact. I have written a treatise upon the subject. I flatter myself that I can distinguish at a glance the ash of any known brand, either of cigar or of tobacco. It is just in such details that the skilled detective differs from the Gregson and Lestrade type.
What on earth did you mean by the florid face?
That was a more daring shot. Though I have no doubt that it was right. You must not ask me that at the present state of the affair.
My head is in a whirl. The more one thinks of it, the more mysterious it grows. How came those two men, if there were two men, into an empty house? What has become of the cabman who drove them? How could one man compel another man to take poison? Where did the blood come from? What was the object of the murder, since robbery had no part in it? How came the woman's ring to be there? Above all, why should the second man write up the German word Rache before decamping? Now, I confess that I cannot see any possible way of reconciling all these facts.
You sum up the difficulties of the situation succinctly, and well, there is much that is still obscure, though I have quite made up my mind on the main facts. As to poor Lestrade's discovery, it was simply a blind intended to put the police upon the wrong track by suggesting socialism and secret societies. It was not done by a German. The A, if you noticed, was printed somewhat after the German fashion. Now, a real German invariably prints in the Latin character, so that we may safely say that this was not written by a German, but by a clumsy imitator who overdid his part. It was simply a ruse to divert inquiry into a wrong channel. I'm not going to tell you much more of the case. Doctor, you know a conjurer gets no credit once he has explained his trick. And if I show you too much of my method of working, you will come to the conclusion that I'm a very ordinary fellow, after all.
I shall never do that. You have made detection as near to an exact science as it will ever be brought in this world.
I'll tell you one other thing. Patent leathers and square toes came in the same cab, and they walked down the pathway together, as friendly as possible, arm in arm, in all probability. When they got inside, they walked up and down the room, or rather, patent leathers stood still, while square toes walked up. up and down. I could read all that in the dust, and I could read that as he walked, he grew more and more excited. That is shown by the increased length of his strides. He was talking all the while and working himself up, no doubt, into a fury. Then the tragedy occurred. I've told you all I know myself now. For the rest is mere surmise and conjecture. We have a good working basis, however, on which to start, but we must hurry up. But I want to catch Halley's concert this afternoon, and we have yet to interview the gallant constable.
I made my report at the office. I've been on duty all night, so if you don't mind, gentlemen...
I'm sure half a sovereign might enable us to hear it all from your own lips.
Oh, well, I shall be most happy to tell you anything I can.
Just let us hear it, all in your own way, as it occurred.
I was taking a look round my beat with PC Harry Murcher at about 1 o'clock in the morning. And it was raining. Precious dirty and lonely it was. Didn't meet a soul, though a cab or two went past. I was strolling down, thinking between ourselves how uncommon handy a forage in hot would be, when suddenly the glint of light caught my eye in the window of that house. I knew it was empty, see. Last tenant who lived there died of typhoid fever. Knocked all in a heap, I was. Reckoned something was wrong, so I got to the door.
You stopped, and then walked back to the garden gate. What did you do that for?
Why, that's true, sir. Though, how you come to know it, heaven only knows. You see, when I got up to the door, it was so still and lonesome that I thought I could do with some company. I walked back to find Harry Murcher's lantern, but there wasn't no sign of him, nor of anyone else.
There was no one in the street?
Not a living soul, sir. Nor as much as a dog. Then I pulled myself together and went back and pushed the door open. All was quiet inside, so I went into the room where the light was burning. There was a candle flickering on the mantelpiece. It was a red wax one. By its light, I saw this...
Yes, I know all that you saw. You walked around the room several times, and you knelt by the body, and then you walked through and tried the kitchen door. And then...
Struth! Where was you hid to see all that? Seems to me that you know a great deal more than you should.
Here's my card. Don't start arresting me for the murder. I am one of the hounds and not the wolf. Mr. Gregson or Mr. Lestrade will answer for that. Go on. What did you do next?
Well, I went back to the gate and sounded my whistle, and that brought Murcher and two more to the spot.
Was the street empty then?
Well, it was as far as anybody that could be of any good goes.
What do you mean?
Oh, I've seen many a drunk chap in my time, but never anyone so crying drunk as that old soak. He was at the gate when I came out, leaning up against the railings, and singing at the pitch of his lungs about Columbine's newfangled banner or such stuff. He couldn't stand, far less help.
What sort of man was he?
He was an uncommon drunk sort of man. He'd have found himself in the station if we hadn't been so took up.
His face, his dress, didn't you notice them?
I should think I did notice them, seeing that I had to prop him up, me and Murcher between us. He was a long chap with a red face.
Holmes! Quiet. What became of him?
We'd enough to do without looking after him. I'll wager he found his way home all right.
Huh. How was he dressed?
Brown overcoat.
Had he a whip in his hand?
A whip? No.
He must have left it behind. You didn't happen to see or hear a cab after that?
No.
There's half a sovereign for you. I'm afraid, Rance, that you will never rise in the force. That head of yours should be for use as well as ornament. You might have gained your sergeant's stripes last night. The man whom you held in your hands is the man who holds the clue of this mystery, and whom we are seeking.
Now, look
there
here,
is
sir.
No use arguing about it now. I tell you that it is so. Come along, Doctor.
Yes.
A blundering fool. Just to think of his having such an incomparable bit of luck and not taking advantage of it.
I'm rather in the dark still. It is true that the description of this man tallies with your idea of the second party in this mystery. But why should he come back to the house after leaving it? That is not the way of criminals.
The ring, man, the ring. That was what he came back for. If we have no other way of catching him, we can always bait our line with the ring. I shall have him, Doctor. I'll lay you 2-1 that I have him. I must thank you for it all. I might not have gone but for you. And I would have missed the finest study I ever came across. A study in scarlet, eh? Why shouldn't we use a little art jargon? There's the scarlet thread of murder running through the colourless skein of life, and our duty is to unravel it and isolate it and expose every inch of it. And now for lunch, and then a concert by Norman Neruda. Her attack and her phrasing, I think, is splendid in the Beethoven.
I'm so exhausted. Can't sleep. Keep seeing that awful, distorted, baboon-like face of Mr. Enoch J. Drebber of Cleveland glaring at me. Ah, Holmes is back.
It was magnificent. Magnificent. Do you remember what Darwin says about music? He claims that the power of producing and appreciating it existed among the human race long before the power of speech was arrived at. Perhaps that is why we are so subtly influenced by it. But are vague memories in our souls of those misty centuries when the world was in its childhood?
That's rather a broad idea.
One's ideas must be broad as nature if they are to interpret nature. My dear Watson, what's the matter? You're not quite yourself. This Brixton Road affair has upset you?
To tell the truth, it has. I ought to be more care-hardened after my Afghan experiences. I saw my own comrades hacked to pieces at Meyerwand without losing my nerve.
I can understand. There is a mystery about this, which stimulates the imagination. Where there is no imagination, there is no horror. Have you seen the evening paper?
No.
It gives a fairly good account of the affair. It does not mention the fact that when the man was raised up, a woman's wedding ring fell upon the floor. It is just as well it does not.
Why?
Look at this advertisement. I had one sent to every paper this morning, immediately after the affair.
Found in Brixton Road this morning, a plain gold wedding ring found in the roadway between the White Hart Tavern and Holland Grove. Apply Dr. Watson. 221B Baker Street, between 8 and 9 this evening.
Excuse me using your name. If I used my own, some of these dunderheads would recognise it and want to meddle in the affair.
Oh, that's all right. But supposing anyone applies, I have no ring.
Oh, yes, you have. Here. This will do very well. It is almost a facsimile.
And who do you expect will answer this advertisement?
Why, the man in the brown coat. Our florid friend with the square toes. If he does not come himself, he will send an accomplice.
Would he not consider it as too dangerous?
Not at all. If my view of the case is correct, and I have every reason to believe that it is, this man would rather risk anything than lose the ring. I believe he dropped it while stooping over Drebber's body and did not miss it at the time. After leaving the house, he discovered his loss and hurried back, but found the police already in possession, owing to his own folly in leaving the candle burning. He had to pretend to be a drunk in order to allay the suspicions which might have been aroused by his appearance at the gate. Now, put yourself in his place. On thinking the matter over, it must have occurred to him that it was possible that he had lost the ring in the road after leaving the house. What would he then do? He would eagerly look out for the evening paper in the hope of seeing it among the articles found. His eye, of course, would alight upon this. He would be overjoyed. Why should he fear a trap? There would be no reason in his eyes why the finding of the ring should connect him with the murder. He would come. He will come. You shall see him within an hour.
And then?
Oh, you can leave me to deal with him then. Have you any arms?
I have my old service revolver and a few cartridges.
You'd better clean it and load it. He will be a desperate man, and though I shall take him unawares, it is as well to be ready for anything.
Haven't cleaned this revolver for years. Bullets. Right. Ready for action.
The plot thickens. I have just had an answer to my American telegram. My view of the case is the correct one.
And that is?
My fiddle will be better for new strings. Put your pistol in your pocket. When the fellow comes, speak to him in an ordinary way. Leave the rest to me. Don't frighten him by looking at him too hard.
It's 8 o'clock now.
Yes. He will probably be here in a few minutes. Open the door slightly. That will do. Oh, now put the key on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. There's a servant passing along the hall.
Just Dr. Watson.
Come in.
Good Lord, it's an old woman. No man of violence here. Here she is, blinking in the light and fumbling in her pocket with shaky fingers. Holmes looks so disconsolate, I shall burst out laughing if he doesn't stop.
It's the scissors brought me, good gentleman.
Oh, she's dropped another curtsy.
A gold wedding ring in the Brixton Road. It belongs to my girl Sally, who was married only this time 12 months, which her husband is steward aboard a union boat, and what he'd say if he'd come home and found her without her ring is more than I can think, he being short enough at the best of times, but more especially when he has the drink. If it please you, she went to the circus last night along with...
Is that her ring?
The Lord be thanked. Sally will be a glad woman this night. That's the ring.
And what may your address be?
13 Duncan Street, Houndsditch. A weary way from here.
The Brixton Road does not lie between any circus and Houndsditch.
The gentleman asked me for my address. Sally lives in lodgings at 3 Mayfield Place, Peckham.
And your name is?
My name is Sawyer. Hers is Dennis, which Tom Dennis married her. And a smart, clean lad, too, as long as he's at sea, and no steward in the company more thought of. But when on shore, what with the women and what with liquor shops?
What am I to do, Holmes? Ah, he's nodded. Here is your ring, Mrs. Sawyer. It clearly belongs to your daughter, and I am glad to be able to restore it to the rightful owner.
I'm most grateful to you too, gentlemen. You saved our lives. Thank you so much. I'm most sorry I can't show more what I feel as gratitude. Good night. Good night.
I'll call him up. She must be an accomplice, and will lead me to him.
Wait up for me.
But Holmes!
There she goes, walking feebly. Ha! And now there's Holmes, some little distance behind. Oh, they're out of view now. Either his whole theory is incorrect, or else he will be led now to the heart of the mystery.
Ah, Watson. Oh. How kind of you to wait up for me. I wouldn't have the Scotland Yarders know it for all the world. I have chafed them so much that they would never let me hear the end of it. I can afford to laugh because I know that I will be even with them in the long run.
What is it, then?
Oh, I don't mind telling the story against myself. That creature had gone a little way when she began to limp and show every sign of being footsore. She came to a halt and hailed a four-wheeler which was passing. I was close enough to hear the address, and she sang it out loud enough to be heard on the other side of the street. Drive to 13 Duncan Street, Houndsditch, she said. Seems genuine enough, I thought. I got up behind. Well, away we rattled and eventually reached the street in question. I hopped off before we came to the door and strolled down the street in an easy, lounging sort of way. I saw the cab pull up, the driver jumped down, and I saw him open the door and stand expectantly. Nothing came out, though. When I reached him, he was groping about frantically in the empty cab and giving vent to the finest assorted collection of oaths that I have ever listened to. There was no sign nor trace of this passenger, and I fear it will be some time before he gets his fare. Number 13 belongs to a respectable paper hanger called Keswick. No person called Sawyer or Dennis had ever lived there.
You don't mean to say that that tottering, feeble old woman was able to get out of the cab while it was in motion without either you or the driver seeing her?
Old woman be damned. We were the old women to be so taken in. It must have been a young man, and an active one, too, besides being an incomparable actor. The get-up was excellent. He saw that he was followed and used this means of giving me the slip. It shows the man we are after is not as lonely as I imagined he was, but as friends who are ready to risk something for him. Now, my dear Watson, you look knocked out. Take my advice. And turn in.
Oh, dear. The morning papers are full of it. They call it the Brixton Mystery. Full of pompous tittle-tattle. What's this in the Daily Telegraph?
The German name of the victim, the absence of all other motive, the sinister inscription on the wall, all point to the perpetration of this vile murder by political refugees and revolutionaries. The socialists have many branches in America, and the deceased had, no doubt, infringed their unwritten laws and been tracked down by them. Wemgericht, Aquatofana, Carbonari, the Marchioness de Brinvilliers, and the Ratcliffe Highway murders. This strange mystery represents a crying need to monitor ever more closely the machinations of foreigners within our realm.
And the Standard saying that these lawless outrages are usual under a liberal administration. They arise out of the unsettling of the minds of the masses.
And the consequent weakening of all authority.
Oh, but this is new. I didn't know this.
The deceased was an American gentleman who had been residing for some weeks in the metropolis. He had stayed at the boarding house of Madame Charpentier in Torquay Terrace, Camberwell. He was accompanied in his travels by his private secretary, Mr. Joseph Stangerson. The two bade adieu to their landlady upon Tuesday and departed to Euston Station with the avowed intention of catching the Liverpool Express. They were afterwards seen together on the platform. Nothing more is known of them until Mr. Drebber's body was discovered in an empty house in the Brixton Road. Nothing is known of the whereabouts of Stangerson. We are glad to learn that Mr. Lestrade and Mr. Gregson of Scotland Yard are both engaged upon the case. And it is confidently anticipated that these well-known officers will speedily throw light upon the matter.
Well, indeed they might. What's the Daily News to say upon the matter?
This is clear. Collection of all that they had undergone.
Dear, dear. What's this about Stangerson?
Every effort should be made to find the secretary Stangerson and to ascertain some particulars of the habits of the deceased. A great step has been gained by the discovery of the address of the house at which he had boarded, a result which was entirely due to the acuteness and energy of Mr. Gregson of Scotland Yard.
Good morning, Holmes. Have you seen the papers?
I told you, whatever happens, Lestrade and Gregson will be sure to score.
That depends on how it turns out.
Oh, bless you, it doesn't matter in the least. If the man is caught, it will be on account of their exertions. If he escapes, it will be in spite of their exertions. It's heads I win, tails you lose. Whatever they do, they'll have followers. Se trouve toujours un plus so qu'il admire.
Just who do you think you are? Get out of here! I'll call the police.
What on earth is going on?
That, my dear Watson, is the Baker Street Division of the Sherlock Holmes Detective Force.
Good God. The dirtiest and most ragged collection of street urchins I have ever clapped my eyes on.
Here we are. Come on, are you? Come on, you lot. Come on.
In future, you shall send up Wiggins alone to report, and the rest of you must wait in the street.
Yeah. That's right.
Have you found it, Wiggins?
No, sir, we ain't.
I hardly expected you would. You must keep on until you do. Here are your wages.
Oh, right. Oh, thank you kindly, Mr. Holmes.
Now off you go, and come back with a better report next time.
Well, come on, you lot, come on.
Clear off the lot of you! I'm watching all of you, you thieving little beggars! Get out of here!
Hey, shut up.
There's more work to be got out of one of those little beggars than half a dozen of the force. The mere sight of an official-looking person seals men's lips. These youngsters, however, go everywhere and hear everything. They're as sharp as needles, too. All they need is organisation.
Have you been employing them on the Brixton case?
Yes. There is a point which I wish to ascertain. It is merely a matter of time. We are going to hear some news now, my dear Watson. Gregson's coming down the road with self-satisfaction written all over every feature of his face. Yes. He's stopping. There he is.
My dear fellow, congratulate me. I have made the whole thing as clear as day.
Do you mean that you're on the right track?
The right track? Why, sir, we have the man under lock and key.
And his name is?
Arthur Charpentier, sub-lieutenant in Her Majesty's Navy.
My dear Gregson, take a seat and try one of these cigars.
Oh,
we are anxious to know how you managed it. Will you have some whiskey and water?
Oh, I don't mind if I do. The tremendous exertions which I've gone through during the last day or two have worn me out. Not so much a bodily exertion, you understand. No, it's a strain on the mind. You'll appreciate that, Mr. Sherlock Holmes. We are both brain workers.
You do me too much honour. Let us hear how you arrived at this most gratifying result.
Oh, thank you. The fun of it is that the fool Lestrade, who thinks himself so smart, has gone off on the wrong track altogether. He's after the secretary, Stangerson, who had no more to do with the crime than the babe unborn. I have no doubt that he is caught up with him by this time.
And how did you get your clue?
Ah, I'll tell you about it. Of course, Dr. Watson, this is strictly between ourselves.
Oh.
The first difficulty that we had to contend with was the finding of this American's antecedents. Some people would have waited until their advertisements were answered, or until parties came forward and volunteered information. That is not Tobias Gregson's way to work. You remember the hat beside the dead man?
Yes, by John Underwood and Sons, 129 Camberwell Road.
I had no idea that you noticed that. Have you been there?
No.
Ah, you should never neglect a chance, however small it may seem.
To a great mind, nothing is little.
Well, I went to Underwood and asked him if he had sold a hat of that size and description. He looked over his books and came on it at once. He'd sent the hat to a Mr. Drever, residing at Charpentier's boarding establishment, Torquay Terrace. Thus I got his address.
Smart. Very smart.
I next called upon Madame Charpentier. I found her very pale and distressed. An uncommonly fine-looking woman she is, too. But she was looking red about the eyes, and her lips trembled as I spoke to her. That didn't escape my notice. I began to smell a rat. You know that feeling, Mr. Sherlock Holmes, when you come upon the right scent, a kind of thrill in your nerves. Have you heard of the mysterious death of your late boarder, Mr. Enoch J. Drebber of Cleveland, I asked? She nodded. She didn't seem able to get out a word. I felt more than ever that she knew something of the matter. I asked the next question. A very important question this was.
No, I'm sure.
At what o'clock did Mr. Drebber leave your house for the train?
At 8 o'clock. His secretary, Mr. Stangerson, said that there were two trains, one at 9:15 and one at 11. He was to catch the first.
And that was the last which you saw of him? A terrible change came over the woman's face as I asked the question. Her features turned perfectly livid. It was some seconds before... Plainly, I do not think that is the whole truth. Hmm? You had best tell me all that you know about it now. Half confidences are worse than none. Besides, you do not know how much we know of it.
Oh, sir, I will tell you all, sir. Do not imagine that my agitation on behalf of my son arises... That, however, is surely impossible. His high character, his profession, his antecedents would all forbid it.
Yes, your best way is to make a clean breast of the facts. Depend on it, if your son is innocent, he will be none the worse.
It seems I have no alternative. I will tell you all without omitting any particular.
It's your wisest course.
Mr. Drebber has been with us nearly 3 weeks. He and his secretary, Mr. Stangerson, had been travelling on the continent. I noticed a Copenhagen label upon each of their trunks, showing that had been their last stopping place. Stangerson was a quiet, reserved man, but his employer, I'm sorry to say, was quite the other extreme. He was coarse in his habits and brutish in other ways. The very night of his arrival, he became very much the worse for drink. And indeed, after 12 o'clock in the day, he could hardly ever be said to be sober. His manners towards the maidservants were disgustingly free and familiar. Worst of all, he speedily assumed the same attitude towards my daughter Alice, and spoke to her more than once in a way which, fortunately, she's too innocent to understand. On one occasion, he actually seized her in his arms and embraced her, an outrage which caused his own secretary to reproach him for his unmanly conduct.
Why did you stand all this? I suppose you can get rid of your boarders when you wish.
Would to God that I had given him notice on the very day that he came. But it was a sore temptation. £14 a week, and this is the slack season. I'm a widow, and my boy in the Navy has cost me much. I grudged to lose the money. I acted for the best. But this last was too much, however, and I gave him notice to leave on account of it. That was the reason of his going.
Well?
My heart grew light when I saw him drive away. My son is on leave just now, but I did not tell him anything of this, for his temper is very fond of his sister. Mm-hmm. When I closed the door behind them, a load seemed to be lifted from my mind. Alas, in less than an hour there was a ring at the bell, and I learned that Mr. Drebber had returned. He was much excited, and evidently the worse for drink. He forced his way into the room where I was sitting with my daughter and made some incoherent remark about having missed the train. He then turned to Alice and before my very face proposed to her that she should fly with him. He said, "You are of age and there is no law to stop you." He said he had plenty of money. His exact words were, "Never mind the old girl here, but come along with me now straight away. You shall live like a princess." I grabbed the wrist and tried to draw her towards the door. I screamed, and at that moment my son Arthur came into the room. What happened then, I do not know. I heard swearing and confused sounds of scuffling. I was too terrified to look. When I did look up, I saw Arthur standing in the doorway, laughing, with a stick in his hand. He said, "I don't think that fellow will trouble us again." He said he would go after him, and with those words he took his hat and started off down the street. The next morning, we heard of Mr. Drebber's mysterious death.
When Madame Charpentier paused, I saw the whole case hung upon one point. Fixing her with my eye, in a way which I have always found effective with women, I asked her at what hour her son had returned.
I do not know.
Not know?
No. He has a latch key, and he let himself in.
After you went to bed?
Yes.
When did you go to bed?
Oh, about 11.
So your son was gone at least 2 hours?
Yes.
Possibly 4 or 5?
Yes.
What was he doing during this time?
I do not know.
Of course, after that, there was nothing more to be done. I found out where Lieutenant Charpentier was, took 2 officers with me, and arrested him. And the death of the scoundrel Drebber. We had said nothing to him about it. So the reference he makes to it is a most suspicious aspect.
Very.
He was still carrying the heavy stick which his mother had described him holding when he followed Drebber. It was a stout oak cudgel.
What is your theory, then?
Well, my theory is that he followed Drebber as far as the Brixton Road. When there, a fresh altercation arose between them. During this, Drebber received a blow from the stick. In the pit of the stomach, perhaps. And this killed him without leaving any mark. The night was so wet that no one was about, so Charpentier dragged the body of his victim into the empty house. As to the candle and the blood, and the writing on the wall, and the ring. They may all be so many tricks to throw the police onto the wrong scent.
Well done. Really, Gregson. You're getting along. We shall make something of you yet.
Well, I flatter myself that I've managed it rather neatly. The young man volunteered a statement in which he said that after following Drebber for some time, Drebber realized he was on his tail. Drebber took a cab to get away from him. On his way home, he claimed he'd met up with an old shipmate. But when we asked him for his address, he could come up with no satisfactory reply. I think the whole case fits together uncommonly well. What really amuses me is to think of Lestrade, who'd started off upon the wrong scent. Afraid he won't make much of it. Why, by Jove, he's the very man himself.
This is a most extraordinary case, a most incomprehensible affair.
Ah, you find it so, Mr. Lestrade. I thought you'd come to that conclusion. Have you managed to find the secretary, Mr. Joseph Stangerson? It's about time we tracked him down.
The secretary, Mr. Joseph Stangerson, has been murdered. He was murdered at Halliday's private hotel about 6 o'clock this morning.
Stangerson, too. The plot thickens.
It was quite thick enough before. I seem to have dropped into a sort of council of war.
Are you sure of this piece of intelligence?
I have just come from his room. I was the first to discover what had occurred.
We have been hearing Gregson's view of the matter. Would you mind letting us know what you have seen and done?
I have no objection. I freely confess that I believe Stangerson was involved in the death of Drebber. This fresh development has shown me that I was completely mistaken. You see, they had been seen together at about 8:30 at Euston Station. At 2 a.m, Drebber's body was found in the Brixton Road. I surmised that they would have put into a hotel or lodging house somewhere in the vicinity.
They would be likely to agree on some meeting place beforehand.
So it proved. I resumed my inquiries early this morning, and at 8 o'clock I reached Halliday's private hotel in Little George Street. I was told at once that Mr. Stangerson was living there. The receptionist even went so far as to say, "No doubt you are the gentleman whom he was expecting. He's been waiting for a gentleman for 2 days." I was told that he was upstairs in bed and wished to be called at 9. And when I got to the door, I saw something which made me feel sickish, despite my 20 years in the force. From under the door, there curled a little red ribbon of blood, which had meandered across the passage and formed a little pool along the skirting at the other side. The receptionist nearly fainted at the sight of it. Although the door was locked, we put our shoulders to it and forced it open. The window of the room was open. Beside the window, all huddled up, lay the body of a man in his nightshirt. He was quite dead, and had been for some time. His limbs were rigid and cold. The receptionist identified the man as being the same who had engaged the room under the name of Joseph Stangerson. The cause of death was a deep stab in the left side. This must have penetrated his heart. And now comes the strangest part of the affair. What do you suppose was above the murdered man?
The word Rache, written in letters of blood?
Well, that was it. A man was seen by a milk boy passing on his way to the dairy. The boy happened to walk down the lane which leads from the mews at the back of the hotel. He noticed that a ladder, which usually lay there, was raised against one of the windows of the second floor, which was wide open. After passing, he looked back and saw a man descend the ladder. The boy thought he was some carpenter or joiner at work in the hotel because he came down so quietly and openly. He had the impression that the man was tall, had a reddish face, and was dressed in a long, brownish coat. He must have stayed in the room for some little time after the murder. We found blood-stained water in the basin where he'd washed his hands, and marks on the sheets where he'd deliberately wiped his knife.
Did you find nothing in the room which could furnish a clue to the murderer?
Nothing. Stangerson had Drebber's purse in his pocket, but it seems that this was usual, as he did do all the paying. There was £80-odd in it, but nothing had been taken. Whatever the motives of these extraordinary crimes, robbery is certainly not one of them. There were no papers or memoranda in the murdered man's pocket, except a single telegram dated from Cleveland about a month ago, and containing the words,
J.H. is in Europe. Mm. And there was no name appended to this message.
Hmm. And there was nothing else?
Nothing of any importance. The man's novel, which he'd been reading himself to sleep with, was lying on the bed, and his pipe was on a chair beside him. There was a glass of water on the table, and on the windowsill a small chip ointment box containing a couple of pills.
The last link. My case is complete. I have now in my hands all the threads which have formed such a tangle. There are, of course, details to be filled in, but I am as certain of all the main facts from the time that Drebber parted from Stangerson at the station up to the discovery of the body of Stangerson as if I had seen them with my own eyes. I will give you proof of my knowledge. Could you lay your hand upon those pills?
I have them. I took them and the purse and the telegram, intending to have them put in a place of safety at the police station. You're very lucky I have them with me now, because I'm bound to say I do not attach any importance to them.
Give them here. Now, Dr. Watson, are these ordinary pills?
I would say not. They're pearly grey and almost transparent to the light. From the lightness and transparency, I should imagine that they're soluble in water.
Precisely so. Now, would you mind going down and fetching that poor little devil of a terrier?
Yes. I won't be a minute.
What's this all about, Holmes?
Would you pass me that saucer from the tea tray? The little dog has been poorly for so long that the landlady wanted the doctor to put it out of its pain yesterday. Now, gentlemen, I will cut one of these pills in two. One half I will place in this wine glass, in which there is a teaspoon of water. You see, our friend the doctor is right. It dissolves easily.
This may be very interesting, but I cannot see what it has to do with the death of Mr. Joseph Stangerson.
Patience, my friend. Patience. You will find in time that it has everything to do with it. I shall now add a little milk to make the mixture palatable. And in presenting it to the dog, I am sure we will find that he'll lap it up readily enough. Ah. My dear Watson, bring the poor wretch over here. Now, we will time the experiment.
Oh, dear. The little dog appears neither the better or worse for its draught of Sherlock Holmes' medicine, and our dear Holmes is looking most distressed.
Mr. Sherlock Holmes, our time is rather valuable. Are we to expect this dog to disappear or turn into an elephant?
It can't be a coincidence. It is impossible that it should be a mere coincidence. The very pills which I suspected in the case of Drebber are actually found after the death of Stangerson, and yet they are inert. What can it mean? Surely my whole chain of reasoning cannot have been false. It is impossible. And yet this wretched dog is none the worse. I have it. Let me cut the other pill and try the same thing. Water. Milk. And now, my poor little terrier, we shall put you out of your misery.
The unfortunate creature's tongue seems to have hardly moistened, and it now gives a convulsive shiver and lies as rigid and lifeless as if it had been struck by lightning.
I should have more faith. I ought to know by this time that when a fact appears to be opposed to a long train of deductions, it invariably proves to be capable of bearing some other interpretation. Of the two pills in the box, one contained the most deadly poison and the other was entirely harmless. I ought to have known that before I saw the box at all. Well, my dear Lestrade and Gregson, all this seems strange to you because you failed at the beginning of the inquiry to grasp the importance of the single real clue which was presented to you. I had the good fortune to seize upon that, and everything which has occurred since then has served to confirm my original supposition, and indeed was the logical sequence of it. Hence, things which have perplexed you and made the case more obscure have served to enlighten me and to strengthen my conclusions. It is a mistake to confound strangeness with mystery. The most commonplace crime is often the most mysterious, because it presents no new or special features from which deductions may be drawn. This murder would have been infinitely more difficult to unravel had the body of the victim been simply found lying in the roadway without any of those sensational accompaniments which have rendered it so remarkable. These strange details, far from making the case more difficult, have really had the effect of making it less so.
Look here, Mr. Sherlock Holmes. We're all ready to acknowledge that you're a smart man and that you have your own methods of working. But we want something more than mere theory and preaching now. It is a case of finding the man. I've made my case out, and it seems I was wrong. Young Charpentier could not have been engaged in this second affair. Lestrade went after his man, Stangerson, and it appears he was wrong, too. You've thrown out hints here and hints there, and seem to know more than we do. But the time has come when we feel we have a right to ask you straight out how much you do know of this business. Can you name the man who did it?
I cannot help feeling that Gregson is right, sir. We both tried, and we both failed. You've remarked more than once since I've been in the room that you had all the evidence which you require. Surely you will not withhold it any longer.
Any delay in arresting the assassin might give him time to perpetrate some fresh atrocity.
Mm-hmm. There will be no more murders. You can put that consideration out of the question. You have asked me if I know the name of the assassin. I do. The mere knowing of his name is a small thing, however, compared with the task of laying our hands upon him. This I expect to do very shortly. I have good hopes of managing it through my own arrangements, but it is a thing which needs delicate handling. We have a shrewd and desperate man to deal with, who is supported, as I have had occasion to prove, by another who is as clever as himself. As long as this man has no idea that anyone can have a clue, there is some chance of securing him. But if he had the slightest suspicion, he would change his name and vanish in an instant among the 4 million inhabitants of this great city, without meaning to hurt either of your feelings. I am bound to say that I consider these men to be more than a match for the official force, and that is why I have not asked for your assistance. If I fail, I shall, of course, incur the blame due to this omission, but that I am prepared for. At present, I am ready to promise that the instant that I can communicate with you without endangering my own delicate arrangements, I shall do so.
But
Mr. Sherlock...
It's Sir Wiggins, sir. Please, sir, I have the cab downstairs.
Good boy. Why don't you introduce this brand of handcuffs at Scotland Yard? See how beautifully the spring works? They fasten in an instant.
The old brand is good enough if we can only find the man to put them on.
Very good, very good. The cabman may as well help me with my boxes. Just ask him to step up, Wiggins.
Right-o, Mr. H.
Are you embarking on a long journey? You haven't said anything about it to me.
Patience, my dear Watson, patience. Ah, cabman.
Yes, sir?
Just give me a hand with this buckle over here, will you?
Right, sir.
Gentlemen, let me introduce you to Mr. Jefferson Hope, the murderer of Enoch Drebber and Joseph Stangerson.
I've got his necktie. Pull it. Tie it up. Tie it up.
I've got his hands. I've got his feet.
And we have his cab. It will serve to take him to Scotland Yard. And now, gentlemen, we have reached the end of our little mystery. You are very welcome to put any questions that you like to me now, and there is no danger that I will refuse to answer them.
I guess you're going to take me to the police station. My cab's at the door. If you'll loosen my legs, I'll walk down to it. I'm not so light as I used to be.
Allow me.
What a powerful man. His dark and sunburned face bears an expression of determination and energy which is as formidable as his personal strength.
If there's a place for a chief of police, I reckon you are the man for it. The way you kept on my trail was a caution.
Mm-hmm. Gregson, Lestrade, you had better come with me.
I can drive you.
Good. And Gregson can come inside with me. You too, Doctor. You have taken an interest in the case and may as well stick to us.
Thank you.
What's the prisoner's name?
He is one Jefferson Hope, charged with the murder of Mr. Enoch J. Drebber and Mr. Joseph Stangerson.
The prisoner, Jefferson Hope, will be put before the magistrates in the course of the week. In the meantime, Mr. Jefferson Hope, have you anything that you wish to say? I must warn you that your words will be taken down and may be used against you.
I have a great deal to say. I want to tell you, gentlemen, all about it.
And you better reserve that for your trial.
I may never be tried.
What?
You needn't look startled. It isn't suicide I'm thinking of. Are you a doctor?
Yes, I am.
Then put your hand here, on my chest.
Good God. There's an extraordinary throbbing and commotion going on inside. And I can hear a dull humming and buzzing.
You have an aortic aneurysm.
That's what they call it. I went to a doctor last week about it, and he told me that it is bound to burst before many days are past. It has been getting worse for years. I got it from overexposure and underfeeding among the Salt Lake Mountains. I've done my work now, and I don't care how soon I go, but I should like to leave some account of the business behind me. I don't want to be remembered as a common cutthroat.
Do you consider, sir, that there's any immediate danger?
Most certainly there is.
In that case, it's clearly our duty, in the interests of justice, to take his statement. You're at liberty, sir, to give your account, which I again warn you will be taken down.
My story springs from a region of desolation and silence, where water never flows. The coyote skulks among the scrub. The buzzard flaps heavily through the air. This is the arid, dusty plain that stretches from the northern slope of the Sierra Blanco, where you will find here and there the white bones of oxen and lost men glistening in the sun. My story concerns a solitary traveler taking slow, tired steps down a ravine here in the hope of seeing some signs of water. The date is the 4th of May, 1847. His face is lean and haggard, his long brown hair and beard all flecked and dashed with white dust. His skin hardly more fleshy than a bare skeleton. That man is dying. Dying from hunger, from thirst. He is carrying a large bundle tied up in a gray shawl and slung over his right shoulder.
Not here. I'd have to go in a feather bed 20 years from now anyway. I can't carry this anymore.
Oh. Oh. You hurt me.
I'm sorry. I didn't aim to. Come on. Out you come. How is it now?
Make it well, Papa. My head, the back.
Oh. There. Better, huh?
Mama always kisses me. Where's Mama?
Mother's gone, child. Guess you'll see her soon.
Gone. But she didn't say goodbye, Papa. She's been gone 3 days. Say, it's awful dry, ain't it? Ain't there no water or stuff to eat, Papa?
No. There ain't nothing, dearie. Just be patient a while. And you'll be all right. Put your head up again. Like that. And then you'll feel bullier. Ain't easy to talk when your lips is like leather. But I guess I'd best let you know how the cards lie. Well, what's that you've got?
Pretty things.
Let's have a look here. Right. Micah. Can't block the sun through it, though.
Well, he goes back home. I'll give him to Brother Bob.
Reckon you'll see prettier things than them soon. You just wait a while. You remember when we left the river?
It's so hot, Papa.
Yes, I know, dearie. But you remember, we reckoned we'd strike another river soon. See? But there was something wrong. Compasses or map. Something. Didn't turn up. Water ran out. Just except a little drop. The likes of you and...
I'm thirsty, Papa.
I know. And no water to drink then and none to drink now. And Mr. Benta, he was the first to go. You remember him?
Yes, Papa.
Then Indian Pete. And then Mrs. McGregor. Then Johnny Holmes. And then...
Yes, Papa.
And then your poor mother.
Then Mother's dead. Mama's dead.
Yes. Yes, they all went except you and me. I thought there was some chance of water in this direction. And we've tramped it together. Doesn't seem to have done any good. There's an almighty small chance for us now.
Are we gonna die, Papa?
I guess that's about the size of it.
As long as we die together, we'll be with Mother again.
Reckon you're right there, child.
How long?
I don't know. Not very long. Not the prettiest birds alive. When they join you for company, people say you ain't got much time to go.
Say, Papa, did God make this country?
Of course he did.
He made the country down in Illinois. And he made the Missouri. But I guess somebody else made the country in these parts.
Side by side, these two wanderers made a strange sight for the buzzards. They knelt down and offered a silent prayer, and then slumped down in the shadow of a large boulder. The child was asleep on his shoulder. For 3 days and 3 nights, he had allowed himself no sleep and no rest. Slowly, the eyelids drooped over the tired eyes, and his head sunk lower and lower upon his chest, and both slept a deep and dreamless sleep. Far, far away in the distance, a little spray of dust rose up, very slight at first, but gradually growing higher and broader until it formed a solid, well-defined cloud. The cloud continued to increase in size until it was clear it could only be raised by a great multitude of creatures. Through the haze, canvas-covered wagons and armed horsemen in a great caravan. When the head of it reached the base of the mountains, the rear could not be seen on the horizon.
So we shall reach the Rio Grande.
Fear not for water. He who depart from the rock will not now abandon his chosen people.
Yes. Whoa.
There. Redskins.
There can't be any number of Indians here. We've passed the Pawnees.
And there are no other tribes until we cross the Great Mountains.
Shall I go forward and see Brother Stangerson?
Leave your horses below, and we will await you here.
As the young men climbed the dusty white slopes, they were heading for a little plateau and a single giant boulder. From the distance, all they could see was a fluttering little wisp of pink cloth.
They look like ants up there.
They've stopped.
What can you see?
I can't make it out. Look there. They found something.
They had found a tall, long-bearded and hard-featured man, thin and unconscious. And beside him, the body of a little child, her round arms encircling his brown, sinewy neck, her golden-haired head resting on his chest. And three solemn buzzards.
Jesus! They're still alive?
Get away!
This is what they call delirium, I guess.
Praise the Lord! They're alive!
Ghosts!
Come here, child.
Where have you come from, traveler?
Hell! Talking ghosts.
No, brother. We are the clay that the good Lord molded. Here. I'll wipe the dust from my face.
What is your name, traveler? And how long have you been on your own?
My name's John Ferrier. Me and the little one. All that's left of 21 people. The rest is all dead of thirst and hunger. Way down the south.
Is she your child?
I guess she is now. She's mine. Because I saved her. No man will take her from me. She's Lucy Ferrier. From this day on. Who are you, though? There seems to be a powerful lot of ye.
Nigh upon 10,000. We are the persecuted children of God, the chosen of Angel Moroni.
He appears to have chosen a fair crowd of ye.
Do not jest at that which is sacred. We are those who believe in those sacred writings, drawn in Egyptian letters on plates of beaten gold, which were handed on to the holy Joseph Smith at Palmyra. We have come from Nauvoo, in the state of Illinois, where we have founded our temple. We have come to seek a refuge from the violent man and from the godless, even though it be in the heart of the desert.
I see. You are the Mormons.
That's right. We are the Mormons.
And where are you going?
We do not know. The hand of God is leading us under the person of our prophet. You must come before him. He shall say what is to be done with you.
At the base of the hill, they were surrounded by crowds of pilgrims. They were pushed on towards a wagon with six horses yoked to it. Beside the driver sat a man no more than 30 years of age, but whose massive head and resolute expression marked him as leader. He had been reading a book, but laid it aside to listen to the castaways and the account of their miraculous discovery.
If we take you with us, we can only be as believers in our own creed. We shall have no wolves in our fold. Better far that your bones should bleach in this wilderness than that you should prove to be that little speck of decay which in time corrupts the whole fleet. Will you come with us on these terms?
Well, guess I'll come with you on any terms.
Take him, Brother Stangerson. Give him food and drink, and the child likewise. Let it be your task also to teach him our holy creed.
We have delayed long enough. Forward! On to Zion!
Come with me, brother Ferrier and young Lucy. You'll stay here for some days to recover your strength. In the meantime, remember that now and forever you are of our religion. Brigham has said it, and he has spoken with the voice of Joseph Smith, which is the voice of God.
From the shores of the... Lord, you have led us to this broad valley of Utah, and this shall be our promised land, the land of milk and honey.
Draining and hedging, planting and clearing, our flourishing wheat crop has turned our country golden.
And we offer our great temple as our monument to God's glory. Here in the center of the city, taller and larger than the highest tree.
Brother Ferrier is a useful guide and a tireless hunter.
He should be provided with land.
He has a farm as large and fertile as any elder. His log house has been built into a substantial villa.
He works morning and evenings.
3 years and he's better off than our neighbors. 6 years and he is well-to-do.
9 years and he is rich.
12 years and there are not a half a dozen men in Salt Lake City who can compare with him. He refuses to take a wife.
He will not be persuaded.
He looks down on those who have many wives.
Perhaps he spurns the teachings of our prophet.
Greed of wealth, he fears the expense.
An early love affair? A fair-haired girl pining away on the shores of the Atlantic?
Young Lucy grows taller and stronger with every year.
Lithe, girlish, tripping through the wheat fields.
Riding her daddy's Mustang with all the ease and grace of a true child of the West.
Bud blossoms into flower.
As fair a specimen of American girlhood as could be found in the whole Pacific slope.
She will make someone a good and worthy wife.
It was not her father who first discovered that the child had developed into the woman. It seldom is in such cases. That mysterious change is too subtle and too gradual to be measured by dates. Least of all does the maiden herself know it until the tone of a voice or the touch of a hand sets her heart thrilling within her, and she learns, with a mixture of pride and of fear, that a new and larger nature has awoken within her. It was a warm June morning. Gold fever had broken out in California. The overland route of tired immigrants lay through this city of the elect, the Latter-day Saints.
Steady now, Poncho.
Just hold on there. I've got your horse's bridle here. We'll be through the drove. You just hold on there. You're not hurt, I hope, Miss.
Oh, I'm awful frightened. Who'd have thought Poncho would be so scared by a load of cows?
Cattle caught him on their horns. Thank God you kept your seat. I guess you're the daughter of John Ferrier. I saw you ride down from his house.
Say, you do a lot of watching.
Well, when you see him, ask him if he remembers the Jefferson Hopes of St. Louis. If he's the same Ferrier, my father and he were pretty thick.
Hadn't you better come and ask him yourself?
Well, I'll do so. We've been in the mountains for 2 months and are not in a visiting condition. He'll have to take us as he finds us.
He has a good deal to thank you for. And so have I. He's awful fond of me. If those cows had jumped on me, he'd never have got over it.
Well, neither would I.
You? Well, I don't see that it would make much matter to you anyhow. I mean, you ain't even a friend of ours. Oh, there, I didn't mean that. Of course, you are a friend now. You must come and see us. But now, I must push along here, or Father won't trust me with his business anymore. Goodbye!
You can't believe how the sight of this fair young girl, as frank and wholesome as the Sierra breezes, had stirred my untamed heart to its very depths. We had been prospecting for silver in the Nevada mountains, yet the love which sprang in my heart was so wild and fierce that I could think of nothing else. I wooed that young woman harder than I had explored any silver lode. Night after night I called on John Ferrier and talked my heart away in the company of Lucy's bright, happy eyes, which told me her young heart was no longer her own. I am off, Lucy. I won't ask you to come with me now, but will you be ready to come when I am here again?
And when will that be?
A couple of months at the outside. I will come and claim you then. There's no one who can stand between us.
And Father?
He's given his consent. Provided we can get these mines working all right, I have no fear on that head.
In that case, there's no more to be said.
Why, thank God. It's settled. But the longer I stay here, the harder it'll be to go. They're waiting for me at the canyon. Goodbye, my darling. Goodbye. In 2 months' time, I shall see you.
Our women in the land of the saints are few, and our men need wives.
I will not allow Lucy to marry a Mormon.
Brother Ferrier has neither married nor arranged his daughter.
Victims of persecutors are now turned persecutors.
Swift retribution will fall on the heads of those who cast perverted clouds over the state of Utah.
Brother Cookson held out against the church and vanished away.
God has exacted punishment on the deviant.
His wife and children wait at home, but he will not return.
The judges have spoken. Amen.
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 One rash word, one hasty act, annihilation.
Praise the Lord God of Zion. The prophet delivered unto us the brides of our future.
Pining, weeping women that bear upon their faces the traces of inextinguishable horror.
The Indians are murdering immigrants hereabouts and stealing the white women.
Suddenly appearing in the harems of elders.
Armed, masked men, stealthy, noiseless, flitting through the darkness.
The avenging angels.
Brother Ferrier, the true believers have been good friends to you. We picked you up when you were starving in the desert. We shared our food with you, led you safe to the chosen valley, gave you a goodly share of land, and allowed you to wax rich under our protection. Is this not so?
It is so.
In return for all this, we asked but one condition. That was that you should embrace the true faith and conform in every way to its usages. This you promised to do. And this, if common report says truly, you have neglected.
And how have I neglected it? Have I not given to the common fund? Have I not attended at the temple? Have I not?
Where are your wives? Call them in, that I may greet them.
It is true that I have not married. But women are few, and there were many who had better claims than I. I was not a lonely man. I had my daughter to attend to my wants.
It is of that daughter that I would speak to you. She has grown to be the flower of Utah, and has found favor in the eyes of many who are high in the land.
Oh.
There are stories of her which I would fain disbelieve. Stories that she is sealed to some Gentile. This must be the gossip of idle tongues. What is the 13th rule in the code of the sainted Joseph Smith? Let every maiden of the true faith marry one of the elect, for if she wed a Gentile, she commits a grievous sin. This being so, it is impossible that you, who profess the holy creed, should suffer your daughter to violate it. Upon this one point, your whole faith shall be tested. So it has been decided in the Sacred Council of Four. The girl is young, and we would not have her wed gray hairs. Neither would we deprive her of all choice. We elders have many heifers, but our children must also be provided. Stangerson has a son, and Drebber has a son, and either of them would gladly welcome your daughter to their house. Let her choose between them. They are young and rich and of the true faith. What say you to that?
You will give us time. My daughter is very young, and she is scarce of an age to marry.
She shall have a month to choose. At the end of that time, she shall give her answer. It were better for you, John Ferrier, that you and she were now lying blanched skeletons upon the Sierra Blanco, than that you should put your weak wills against the orders of the Holy Four.
Father?
Lucy.
I could not help it. His voice rang through the house. Oh, Father. Father, what should we do?
Well, don't scare yourself. We'll fix it up somehow or other. You don't find your fancy kind of lessening for this fellow Jefferson, do you?
No, Father.
No, of course not. I shouldn't care to hear you say you did. He's a likely lad, and he's a Christian, which is more than these folk here, in spite of all their praying and preaching. There's a party starting for Nevada tomorrow, and I'll manage to send him a message letting him know the hole we're in. If I know anything of that young man, he'll be back here with a speed that would whip electrotelegraphs. When he comes, he'll advise us for the best. But it is for you that I am frightened. One hears such dreadful stories about those who oppose the prophet. Something terrible always happens to them.
But we haven't opposed him yet.
It'll be time to look out for squalls when we do. We have a clear month before us. At the end of that, I guess we had best shin out of Utah.
Leave Utah?
That's about the size of it.
But the farm...
We will raise as much as we can in money and let the rest go. To tell the truth, Lucy, it isn't the first time I have thought of doing it. I don't care for knuckling under to any man, as these folk do to their darned prophet. I'm a freeborn American, and it's all new to me. Guess I'm too old to learn. If he comes browsing about this farm, he might chance to run up against a charge of buckshot traveling in the opposite direction.
But they won't let us leave.
Wait till Jefferson comes, and we'll soon manage that. In the meantime, don't fret yourself. And don't get your eyes swelled up, else he'll be tearing into me when he sees you. There's nothing to be afraid about. And there's no danger at all.
On that very morning, John Ferrier went into Salt Lake City, tracked down his acquaintance bound for the Nevada mountains, and entrusted him with the secret message to me. As he approached his farm, he was surprised to see a horse hitched to each of the posts of the gate. Still more surprised was he on entering, to find two young men occupying his sitting room. One, with a long, pale face, was leaning back in the rocking chair with his feet cocked up upon the stove. The other, a bull-necked youth with coarse, bloated features, was standing in front of the window with his hands in his pockets, whistling.
Maybe you don't know us. This here is the son of Elder Drebber, and I'm Joseph Stangerson, son of Elder Stangerson, who...
As he will all the nations in his own good time, he grindeth slowly but exceedingly small.
And we have come, at the advice of our fathers, to solicit the hand of your daughter for whichever of us may seem good to you. As I have but four wives, and Brother Drebber here has seven, it appears to me that my claim is the stronger one.
Nay, Brother Stangerson, the question is not how many wives we have, but how many wives we can keep. My father has now given over his mills to me, and I am the richer man.
But my prospects are better. When the Lord removes my father, I shall have his tanning yard and his leather factory. Then I am your elder and am higher in the church.
It will be for the maiden to decide. We will leave it all to her decision.
Look here. When my daughter summons you, you can come. But until then, I don't want to see your faces here again. There are two ways out of the room. There is the door and there is the window. Now, which do you care to use? Let me know when you have settled which it is to be.
You shall smart for this. You have defied the prophet and the council of four. You shall rue it to the end of your days.
The hand of the Lord shall be upon you. He will rise and smite you.
Then I'll start the smiting.
Father! Father, no, Father. Let them go.
The young canting rascals. I would sooner see you in your grave, my girl, than the wife of either of them.
And so should I, Father. But Jefferson will soon be here.
Yes. It'll not be long before he comes. The sooner the better. For we do not know what their next move will be.
In the whole history of the settlement, there has never been such a case of rank disobedience to the authority of the elders.
What shall be the fate of this arch-rebel?
His wealth and position shall be of no avail to him.
Others as well known and as rich as him have been snatched by the talons of the Lord and cast to the depths of hell.
He will be warned.
The avenging angels shall pin their remonstrance to the very cover of his bed.
And they shall say, 29 days are given for amendment, and then...
The hand which fastened this pin might just as well have struck him through the heart.
And the next morning the avenging angels shall mark his seating with a burned stick.
And they shall say the number 28.
And on the following morning the number 27 shall be painted upon the outside of his door.
And this register shall be kept daily.
Upon the walls, sometimes upon the floors, occasionally on small placards nailed to the garden gate and railings.
See how haggard and restless the traitor becomes.
He has the eyes of a hunted and wretched creature.
20 to 15, and 15 to 10.
And no amendment.
5 to 4, and 4 to 3. He casts his eyes north to south and east to west.
We have his farm surrounded.
No road unguarded. 3 to 2.
What the hell's that?
So they have come. Perhaps this is their way of marking up that the last day of grace has arrived. I will present them with a ready target. Instant death is better than this torturing of the nerves.
Nothing. Nobody. Good God, some wounded or dying man. Hey, you okay? Good Lord, how you scared me. Whatever made you come in like that?
Give me food. I haven't had time to eat for 2 days.
Here, son.
You don't know how glad I am to see you.
Does Lucy bear up well?
Yes, and she does not know the real danger.
Well, that is well. The house is watched on every side. That is why I crawled my way up to it. They may be darn sharp, but they're not quite sharp enough to catch a Washoe hunter.
You're a man to be proud of. There are not many who would come to share our danger and our troubles.
Well, you've hit it there, pard. I have respect for you. But if you were alone in this business, I'd think twice before I put my head into such a hornet's nest. It's Lucy that brings me here. And before harm comes on her, I guess there will be one less of the Hope family in Utah.
What are we to do?
Tomorrow is your last day. Unless you act tonight, you are lost. I have a mule and two horses waiting in the Eagle Ravine. How much money have you got?
$2,000 in gold and $5,000 in notes.
That'll do. I have as much more to add to it. We must push for Carson City through the mountains. You'd best wake Lucy. It's as well that the servants do not sleep in the house.
John Ferrier woke Lucy to prepare her for our journey. I packed all the provisions into a small parcel and filled a stoneware jar with water. The mountain wells were few and far between. Ferrier appeared with Lucy, all dressed and ready, and looking more beautiful than I had ever remembered her. We had a few precious minutes to smile and embrace.
We must make our start at once. The front and back entrances are watched, but if we're careful, we might get away through the side windows and across the fields. Once on the road, we're only 2 miles from the ravine where the horses are waiting. By daybreak, we should be halfway through the mountains.
What if we are stopped?
Well, if they are too many for us, we shall take 2 or 3 of them with us.
When a dark cloud obscured the moonlight, we stumbled across the garden with bated breath and crouching as low as our bodies could hold us above the ground. We followed the line of a sheltering hedge until we came to a gap, which opened up into the cornfield. Suddenly. Down!
Tomorrow, at midnight. When the whippoorwill calls 3 times.
It is well. Shall I tell Brother Drebber?
Pass it on to him. And from him to the others. 9 to 7.
7 to 5.
Now, quickly. Hurry on. Hurry on.
I can't keep up.
Here, give me your arm. Hurry. We are through the line of sentinels. Everything depends on speed. Hurry on.
We made it to the canyon. Lucy went upon the mule, Hold Ferrier upon one of the horses, and I led the other horse along the precipitous and dangerous path. Up the great black crag 1,000 feet high, with long basaltic columns on the rugged surface like the ribs of some petrified monster. On the other side there was a wild chaos of boulders and debris. Soon we reached the wildest and most desolate portion of the pass.
Look.
Who goes there?
Travelers from Nevada.
By whose permission?
The Holy Four.
9 to 7?
7 to 5.
Pass and the Lord go with you.
Looking back, we could see the solitary watcher leaning upon his gun, and we knew that we had passed the outlying post of the chosen people, and that freedom lay before us. We rode and climbed the mountains, passing wild torrents. Lucy and Old Ferrier wanted to rest longer during the watering of the horses, but I knew the avenging angels were our days. There was no way of telling how far behind us they were.
Are you all right, Father?
I am fine, child. I have the strength to hold on to the mane of this old horse. And that's strength enough to take us to Carson.
What are you doing? Now the sun is still up, we can move on.
Our food is run out. We can't go on without more provisions. I reckon if you make a fire here, there's game to be had in these mountains. And I won't be long.
And the Mormons?
Well, we must be 30 miles ahead of them. Enough time to gather food and fight them.
Don't be long.
I'll be as quick as I can. Warm yourselves on this fire. It must be 5,000 feet up. It's no wonder the air is bitter and keen.
I left them crouching over the blazing fire, while the 3 animals stood motionless in the background. Then, the intervening rocks hid them from my view.
I walked 2 miles or more through one ravine after another before spying a creature like a giant sheep, the bighorn. I shot him, and he fell down into the valley below. He was far too big to carry on my back, so I cut away one haunch and part of the flank and tried to retrace my steps. Evening was drawing in. I reckon I must have lost my bearings. I had to try all manner of turns and routes, and it must have been 5 hours before I recognized the outline of the cliffs that bound the glen I had left them in.
Hello! Hello!
I found the spot where the fire had been lit. Just a glowing pile of wood ashes there, and dead silence. No living creature near the fire remains. Animal, man, maiden, all gone. I seized a piece of wood from the smoldering fire and blew it into a flame. I could see the ground all stamped down by the feet of horses, and the direction of their tracks proved that afterwards they had turned back to Salt Lake City. Maybe they had taken old Farrier and Lucy back with them. But my eyes then fell upon an object which made every nerve within my body chill to the core. A little way on one side of the camp was a low-lying heap of reddish soil. There was no mistaking it for anything but a newly dug grave. There was a stick planted on it, with a sheet of paper fluttering in the cleft fork. The inscription was brief, but to the point. John Farrier, formerly of Salt Lake City, died August 4th, 1860.
Good day to you, sir.
I am Jefferson Hope. You remember me?
Good God. You are mad to come here. It's as much as my own life is worth to be seen talking with you. Have you not heard? There is a warrant against you from the Holy Four for assisting the Farriers away.
I don't fear them or their warrant. You must know something of this matter, Cooper. I beg you to answer just a few questions. We have always been friends. For God's sake, don't refuse to answer me.
What is it? Be quick. The very rocks have ears and the trees eyes.
What has become of Lucy Farrier?
She was married yesterday to young Drebber.
Oh.
Hold up, man. Hold up. You have no life left in you.
Don't mind me. Married, you say?
Married yesterday. That's what those flags are for in the endowment house. There were some words between young Drebber and young Stangerson as to which was to have her. They'd both been in the party that followed them, and Stangerson shot her father, which seemed to give him the best claim. But when they argued it out in council, Drebber's party was the stronger, so the prophet gave her over to him. No one won't have her very long, though, for I saw death in her face yesterday. She's more like a ghost than a woman. Are you off, then?
Yes, I'm off.
Where are you going?
Never mind!
The trader's daughter is miserable in the hands of Elder Drebber's son.
She has pined away her life. No matter to Drebber, he will inherit her father's farm.
He has no grief for his young bride.
His other wives sat round the beer into the early hours.
And they say the ghost of the Gentile broke in and kissed her cold forehead.
And snatched Drebber's wedding ring from her finger.
And cursed, she shall not be buried in that.
They say he prowls the mountains.
A bullet has whistled through young Stangerson's window and flattened itself against the wall within a foot of his face.
A great boulder has crashed down within a foot of young Drebber at the cliff face.
They are leading expeditions into the mountains to kill the Gentile.
They never go out after nightfall and have their houses guarded.
But now the hills are quiet. They say the fire of vengeance has burnt out his heart.
And the mountain birds nest in his undiscovered skeleton.
Five years it took to recover my strength and wealth in the silver mines of Nevada. I returned to Salt Lake City, disguised and under an assumed name. But the chosen people had fought amongst themselves, and young Drebber and Stangerson had left Utah and become Gentiles. I traveled from town to town throughout the United States. Year passed into year, until I faced Drebber in the window of a store in Cleveland, Ohio. Drebber had recognized the murder in my eyes and persuaded a judge to lock me up with the story that I represented the jealousy and hatred of an old rival. When at last I was liberated on sureties, I found Drebber's house deserted and that he had departed with Stangerson for Europe. Now, Stangerson had fallen on hard times and was now acting as Drebber's secretary. I was determined to track down my enemies from city to city, from St. Petersburg to Paris, from Copenhagen to London. It doesn't much matter to you why I hated these men. It's enough that they were guilty of the death of two human beings, a father and a daughter, and that they had therefore forfeited their own lives. After the lapse of time that has passed since their crime, it was impossible for me to secure a conviction against them in any court. I knew of their guilt, though, and I determined that I should be judge, jury, and executioner all rolled into one. You'd have done the same if you had any manhood in you, if you'd have been in my place. That girl that I spoke of was to have married me 20 years ago. She was forced into marrying that same Drebber and broke her heart over it. I took the marriage ring from her dead finger, and I vowed that his dying eyes should rest upon that very ring, and that his last thoughts should be of the crime for which he was punished. I have carried it about with me, and I have followed him and his accomplice over 2 continents until I caught them. They thought to tire me out, but they could not do it. If I die tomorrow, as is likely enough, I die knowing that my work in this world is done and well done. They have perished, and by my hand. There is nothing left for me to hope for or to desire. You see, I was able to make my living in London by driving a cab. I would dog them and follow them until I saw my opportunity. With my beard, they would not recognize me. But they were very cunning, though. They would never go out alone, and never after nightfall. Drebber himself was drunk half the time. Then one evening they quickly left their boarding house in Torquay Terrace, and with their luggage, ordered a cab to Euston.
Is this the Liverpool train?
Just gone, sir.
Oh, Christ, I told you we should have left earlier.
When is the next one?
Won't be another for some hours, sir.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
Don't fret, sir. I have a little business of my own to deal with. Perhaps you could wait a while. I shall not be very long.
You can't do that. You promised that we would stick together. I'll come with you. It's not worth the risk.
You know, you don't understand. This is a delicate matter. I must go alone.
For God's sake, Drebber, you've never been able to keep your hands off women. She might be poor, but she won't give you the time of day.
Damn you, Stangerson. Just remember, you're nothing but my paid servant. Don't you ever presume to tell me what to do with my life.
Go if you must, but let's not forget there's a hunter on our tail. If you miss the next train, let's arrange to meet at Halliday's private hotel.
The next train to Liverpool leaves at 11. I'll be back on this platform.
The moment for which I had waited so long had at last come. I had my enemies within my power. One of my regular clients looked after some empty houses in Brixton. He had dropped the key to one of them in my carriage. I duplicated it before returning it to him.
By this means, I had access to at least one spot in this great city where I could be free from interruption. How to get Drebber into that house was the difficult problem which I had to solve. He was drinking heavily, and to my astonishment, returned to the lodging house in Torquay Terrace. I waited outside for 15 minutes.
Get out of our house, or I'll thrash you to death. Get your hands off of me. You hound. I'll teach you to insult an honest girl.
I'll say and do what I like, young man, and I won't be flattered.
If you don't get out.
Driver, quick, take me up. Halliday's private hotel.
When I had him fairly inside my cab, my heart jumped so high with joy, I feared that my aneurysm might burst. I drove along slowly, weighing in my own mind what was best to do. I might take him right out into the country and there, in some deserted lane, have my last interview with him. But suddenly, he solved the problem for me.
Driver, stop here. Here, I tell you.
Yes, sir.
One good thing about this goddamn city is the gin palaces. Wait here.
Right, Bob.
And there I waited until closing time. When he came out, he was so far gone, I knew the game was in my own hands. Don't imagine that I intended to kill him in cold blood. Years ago, I had worked as a janitor in the laboratory of New York College, and I had been lucky enough to obtain a deadly South American arrow poison. Poison so powerful that the least grain meant instant death. I worked this poison into small, soluble pills, and each pill I put into a box with a similar pill made without poison. I determined at the time that when I had my chance, each gentleman should draw a pill out of the box, and that I would eat the pill that remained. If any of you have ever pined for a thing, and longed for it during 20 long years, and suddenly found it within your reach, you would understand my feelings. I lit a cigar and puffed at it to steady my nerves, but my hands were trembling and my temples throbbing with excitement. As I drove, I could see old John Ferrier and sweet Lucy looking at me out of the darkness and smiling at me. Just as plain as I see you all in this room. All the way there, they were ahead of me, one on each side of the horse, until I pulled up at the house in Brixton Road. When I looked in at the window, I found Drebber all huddled together in a drunken sleep.
It's time to get out, sir.
All right, Caviar. Come in.
All right, now, mind the step there, sir. It's a nice gentleman. That's all right, sir.
All right. All
careful right. Now. Mm. Mind your step.
I suppose he thought we had come to the hotel that he had mentioned, for he got out without another word and followed me down the garden. I had to walk beside him to keep him steady, for he was still a little top-heavy. When we came to the door, I opened it and led him into the front room. I give you my word that all the way, the father and daughter were walking in front of us.
It's infernally dark.
We'll soon have light. I'll start this candle. Now, Enoch Drebber, who am I?
Or no!
You dog! I've hunted you all the way from Salt Lake City to St. Petersburg, and you've always escaped me. Now, at last, Your wanderings have come to an end, for either you or I shall never see tomorrow's sunrise.
I could see on his face that he thought that I was mad. So I was for the time. The pulses in my temples beat like sledgehammers, and I believe I would have had a fit of some sort if the blood had not gushed from my nose.
Oh, it can't be you. It's impossible. Stangerson!
What do you think of Lucy Ferrier now? Punishment has been slow in coming, but it has overtaken you at last.
Would you murder me?
There is no murder. Who talks of murdering a mad dog? What mercy had you upon my poor darling when you dragged her from her slaughtered father and bore her away to your accursed and shameless harem?
Was it I who killed her father?
But it was you who broke her innocent heart. Let the high god judge between us. Choose and eat. There is death in one and life in the other. I shall take what you leave. Let us see if there is justice upon the earth, or if we are ruled by chance.
No, no, I beg you, brother. I have not murdered a living creature. You must understand the power of the avenging angels. I had no choice. Mercy, please.
I knew you were cowards, and without the power of others, you would never dare to risk your lives in any cause. But as sure as you feel the blade of this knife against your throat, you have...
He eventually obeyed me, and I swallowed the other. And we stood facing one another in silence for a minute or more, waiting to see which was to live and which was to die. Shall I ever forget the look which came over his face when the first warning pangs told him that poison was in his system? I laughed as I saw it, and I held Lucy's marriage ring in front of his very eyes. The blood had been streaming from my nose, but I had taken no notice of it. I don't know what it was that put it into my head to write upon the wall with it. Perhaps it was some mischievous idea of setting the police upon the wrong track, for I felt light-hearted and cheerful. I remembered a German being found in New York with the word Rache written up above him, and it was argued at the time in the newspapers that the secret societies must have done it. I guessed that what puzzled the New Yorkers would puzzle the Londoners. So I dipped my finger in my own blood and printed it on a convenient place on the wall. Having driven some distance from that house in Brixton, I put my hand into the pocket in which I usually kept Lucy's ring and found it was not there. I was thunderstruck. It was the only memento I had of her. I realized that I must have dropped it when stooping over Drebber's body. I was ready to dare anything rather than lose that ring. Back at the house, I walked straight into the arms of a police officer and only managed to disarm his suspicions by pretending to be hopelessly drunk. Stangerson was staying at Halliday's private hotel, and he was more cunning. I hung about all day, but he never came out. I fancy that he suspected something when Drebber failed to put in an appearance, but I soon found out which was the window of his bedroom, and early next morning I took one of the ladders which were lying in the lane behind the hotel.
What the hell?
Joseph Stangerson, the hour has come when you are to answer for the life you took so mercilessly 20 years ago. Brother Drebber is dead.
How can any man be so twisted by vengeance? We're talking about events 20 years old.
Not for me, Stangerson. The innocent faces of that beautiful young woman and her good father are as fresh to me as the look of terror on Drebber's face that I left in Brixton only a matter of hours ago.
We all have to learn to forgive.
I will tell you how dear Brother Drebber died. Here, 2 pills. One will kill in seconds. We drew and left it to God's mercy. And that's the forgiveness I'm going to give you, Stangerson. One will live, the other will die. A chance old John Ferrier never had.
You're mad. I'll kill you with my own 2 bare hands.
murderer!
In self-defense, I stabbed him in the heart. It would have been the same in any case, for Providence would never have allowed his guilty hand to pick out anything but the poison. I have little more to say, and it's as well, for I am about done up. I went on cabbing it for a day or so, intending to keep at it until I could save enough to take me back to America. I was standing in the yard when a ragged youngster asked me if there was a cabbie called Jefferson Hope, and said that his cab was wanted by a gentleman at 221B Baker Street. I went round, suspecting no harm, and the next thing I knew, this young man here had the bracelets on my wrists and as neatly shackled as I ever saw in my life. That's the whole of my story, gentlemen. You may consider me to be a murderer, but I hold that I am just as much an officer of justice as you are.
There is only one point in which I would like a little more information. Who was your accomplice who came for the ring which I advertised?
I can tell you my own secrets, but I don't get other people into trouble. I saw your advertisement, and I thought it might be a plant, or it might be the ring which I wanted. My friend volunteered to go and see. I think you'll own he did it smartly.
No doubt about that.
Now, gentlemen, the forms of the law must be complied with. On Thursday, the prisoner will be brought before the magistrates, and your attendance will be required. Until then, I'll be responsible for him.
My dear Holmes,
I have just returned from the police court. I was called about 2 hours ago. Mr. Jefferson Hope was found this morning stretched upon the floor with a placid smile on his face. The aneurysm burst last night. I can assure you from the expression I saw, I think in his dying moments he was able to look back upon a useful life and on work well done.
Gregson and Lestrade will be wild about his death. Where will their grand advertisement be now?
I don't see that they had very much to do with his capture.
What you do in this world is a matter of no consequence. The question is, what can you make people believe that you have done? Never mind. I would not have missed the investigation for anything. There has been no better case within my recollection. Simple as it was, there were several most instructive points about it.
Simple?
Well, really, it can hardly be described as otherwise. The proof of its intrinsic simplicity is that without any help, save a very few ordinary deductions, I was able to lay my hands upon the criminal within 3 days.
That's true.
In solving a problem like this, the grand thing is to be able to reason backwards. Let me endeavour to show you the different steps of my reasoning. To begin at the beginning, I examined the footway. I saw clearly the marks of the cab, and not a private carriage, by the narrow gauge of its wheels. In the clay soil, I saw the heavy footmarks of the constable, but I also saw the track of the two men who had first passed through the garden. One was remarkable for his height because of the length of his stride, and the other was fashionably dressed because of the small and elegant impression left by his boots. In the house, the body of the well-booted man lay before me. By inference, the tall one, then, had done the murder, if murder there was. There was no wound upon the dead man's person, but the agitated expression upon his face assured me that he had foreseen his fate before it came upon him. Men who die from heart disease or any other sudden natural cause never by any chance exhibit agitation upon their faces. Having sniffed the dead man's lips, I detected a slightly sour smell and came to the conclusion that poison had been forced upon him. The forcible administration of poison is by no means a new thing in the criminal annals. The cases of Dolsky in Odessa and of Leturier in Montpellier will occur to any experienced toxicologist. And now the great question, the reason why. It was not robbery. Nothing had been taken. Was it politics or was it a woman? Political assassins are only too glad to do their work and fly. This murder had been done most deliberately, and the perpetrator had left his tracks all over the room. It must have been a private affair, and not a political one which called for such a methodical revenge. That blood-red writing upon the wall, far too evident, as a blind. Finding the ring settled the question. Clearly the murderer had used it to remind the victim of some dead or absent woman. I then proceeded to examine the room, confirming the murderer's height, establishing his penchant for trichinopoly cigars, and the length of his fingernails. Since there were no signs of a struggle, the blood which covered the floor must have burst from the murderer's nose in his excitement. The track of blood coincided with the track of his feet. It is seldom that any man, unless he is very full-blooded, breaks out in bleeding through emotional distress, so I hazarded the opinion that the criminal was probably a robust and ruddy-faced man. Events have proved that I had judged correctly. Having left the house, I proceeded to do what Gregson had neglected. I telegraphed the head of the police in Cleveland, limiting my inquiry to the circumstances of Enoch Drebber's marriage. The answer was conclusive. Drebber had applied for the protection of the law against an old rival in love, named as Jefferson Hope, and that this same Hope was at present in Europe. All that remained to do now was to secure the murderer. I had determined that the man who had walked into the house with Drebber was none other than the man who had driven the cab. If one man wished to dog another through the streets of London, what better means could he adopt than to turn cab driver? If Jefferson Hope had been one, there was no reason to believe that he had ceased to be. Any sudden change would be likely to draw attention to himself. He would probably, for a time, continue to perform his duties. There was no reason to suppose that he was going under an assumed name. Why should he change his name in a country where no one knew his original one? I therefore organized my street urchin detective corps and sent them systematically to every cab proprietor in London until they ferreted out the man that I wanted. The murder of Stangerson was an incident which was entirely unexpected, but which could hardly in any case have been prevented. You see, the whole thing is a chain of logical sequences without a break or flaw.
It is wonderful. Your merits should be publicly recognized. You should publish an account of the case. If you won't, I will.
You may do what you like, Doctor. See here. Just look at this.
Ah, the Evening Echo. The public have lost a sensational treat through the sudden death of the man Hope, who was suspected of the murder of Mr. Enoch Drebber and Mr. Joseph Stangerson.
The details of the case will probably be never known, though we are informed upon good authority that the crime was the result of an old standing and romantic feud in which love and Mormonism bore a part. If the case has had no other effect, it at least brings out in the most striking manner the efficiency of our detective police force and will serve as a lesson to all foreigners that they will do wisely to settle their feuds at home and not to carry them onto British soil.
It is an open secret that the credit of this smart capture belongs entirely to the well-known Scotland Yard officials, Messrs. Lestrade and Gregson. The man was apprehended, it appears, in the rooms of a certain Mr. Sherlock Holmes, who has himself, as an amateur, shown some talent in the detective line, and who, with some instructors... may hope in time to attain to some degree of their skill. It is expected a testimonial of some sort will be presented to the two officers as a fitting recognition of their services.
Didn't I tell you when we started? That's the result of our study in Scarlet, to get them a testimonial.
Never mind, Holmes. I have all the facts in my journal, and the public shall know them. By Jove, they will!